whatever's been introduced.
I will call to order this hearing of the State and Local Government Operations and Oversight Committee for Wednesday, February 27, 2008. First item on the agenda is approval of the minutes. Are there corrections to the minutes?
Senator Chair, I'll so move.
Senator Betzel moves approval of the minutes. All those in favor of that motion, please say aye.
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 Opposed, no. Motion prevails. Minutes are adopted. First bill on our calendar is Senate File 2807. Senator Saxhog, is this, we have the A1 amendment. Is that an author's amendment?
It is, Madam Chair. I'd move that.
Senator.
Oh, I can't move.
No, can't do it there. Senator Larson moves adoption of the A1 amendment to 2807. All those in favor of that motion, please say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. Now we have Senate File 2807 as amended before. Senator Saxon.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. As you said, Senate File 2807, this bill will allow townships through their residents to thank volunteers, build community, and recognize special services rendered by the township officers and citizens. And with me today is Kent Sulem to briefly go over the bill and help answer any questions.
Mr. Sulem, if you would identify yourself, please, for the record.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Kent Sulem with the Minnesota Association of Townships. And what this bill does, there's now, with the amendment, there's two parts. The amendment addresses subdivision 8 of 36510, which is a statute that has 18 subdivisions of what the electors may do at the annual town meeting, what they can authorize the town board to spend money on or other activities. It was discovered by some of our practitioners preparing for this upcoming annual meeting in a couple of weeks that with the words that are struck by the amendment that was just adopted, if we didn't do that, it triggers the need to actually do it by ballot question and not at the annual meeting. And this language has been removed in other subdivisions of the statute. So it doesn't have any practical impact other than clarify that it is, in fact, done at the annual meeting and not at the separate election. The main part of the bill is a situation where it's been a very common question and in some areas even a practice where we'll get, can we expend monies to recognize volunteers? Can we have a community celebration to recognize the community and build community and that sort of positive thing? And unfortunately, when they ask, we have to say no unless it's specifically tied to historical significance because of some AG opinions and state auditor rulings from past years that recognize that while a valid public purpose exists for these functions, there is not express authority to do so. And so this bill simply provides the express authority for what has been recognized as good public purpose, but lacking authority. It still is controlled by the voters. They still have to authorize it at the meeting. The board can't act on their own authority. It's still self-limiting by the levies set by the people at their meeting. So there is that still check and balance in place.
Are there questions for Senator Saxhog or Mr. Sewell? Senator Lurie.
Actually, I mean, I guess I'd like to speak in favor of this and just offer a personal. I sat on the town board for many years prior to my Senate service, and a couple of years ago, we were going to put up a plaque, had some historical research done. We still got all our records going back forever, and we were going to put up a plaque just in recognition of all of those who had offered their public service throughout the years, and our incredibly efficient clerk notified us of this provision, and we couldn't do it, and we were pretty bummed out about it at the time. It hadn't occurred to me again since serving in the Senate, but I'm very glad to see this moving forward. And so thanks for bringing it, and I hope we can
Senator
move it
Roebling.
Along.
Thank you, Madam Chair. On the amendment, could the electors or town board choose to put this question on a ballot if they wanted to in relation to the parks?
Mr. Sulem?
Senator Roebling, yes. There's a totally separate section of law that says that anything that the voters are authorized to speak on could be submitted as a ballot question. That's covered under state election law in Chapter 205.
Senator Larson?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd move that Senate File 2807 be recommended to pass.
Is there further discussion, Senator Lurie?
I've got one more question regarding the amendment and the timelines for this. If it's got to be done before this year's annual meeting, is that correct? Do we have timing issues? Do we
Mr.
need
Sulem?
To?
Senator Lurie, we did talk about should we have an immediate effective date. I'm not sure both chambers could get it off the floor into the governor in time for this year, but if by having the default, they could still do a special annual meeting and take care of it.
Are there further questions for Senator Saxhauger, Mr. Sulem? Is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify on this bill? Seeing none, we have Senator Larson's motion that Senate File 2807 be recommended to pass. All those in favor of the motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails, and the bill will be sent to the floor.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members?
Members, the next two bills are mine. We're going to take up Senate File 2500 first. Then we'll come back to Senate File, or then we'll go to Senate File 2401, and I will explain, since we have so many testifiers on that, some ground rules for testimony before we begin discussion of it.
Okay, as Chair Rust indicated, we're going to take up Senate File 2500. Welcome to the committee again, Senator Rust. I think to get started on this, we do have a report from the subcommittee on gaming.
Chair, I'll move the subcommittee report.
Okay. Senator Betzold moves the subcommittee report. All in favor? Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. Senator Rust on the bill.
Mr. Chairman, this bill allows for the new track at Columbus to offer simulcasting for all breeds and to enter into an agreement with the Horse Persons Association at Canterbury for a way of increasing the breeders' fund and the purses by the revenues from the simulcasting. Current law only allows the second track, which is authorized by law, to offer simulcasting of the breed that is currently racing at the at that venue. So this creates a level playing field for the Anoka track with Canterbury.
Thank you. Any questions?
Mr. Chairman, we did have a testimony in the subcommittee report.
Yes.
If members who are not on the subcommittee would like to ask questions or have further testimony, we have that available.
Seeing none.
Mr. Chairman, I have the wrong folder here. What's the bill number?
2500.
Mr. Chairman, I move that Senate File 2500 be recommended to pass.
As amended in the subcommittee?
Well, as we already adopted the subcommittee report, so I don't know if that has to be the motion. So that Senate File 2500 be recommended to pass.
Senator Rust recommends that Senate File 2500 be recommended to pass. All in favor?
Well, Mr. Chair, it still was amended.
That's what I thought.
Okay, yes.
Senate File 2500, as amended in the subcommittee, be recommended to pass, is Senator Rust's motion. All in favor of that motion?
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed?
Well, Mr. Chairman, there are other people listed on the agenda.
Oh, yes.
To speak for this, and some of them are not in favor of the bill, so you may want to call on to see if there's anyone who who wants to speak on the bill,
yes,
other than its supporters.
Yes. Anybody in the audience care to come and speak either in favor or opposed to Senate File 2500? Seeing none, the motion before us, as is carried, passes. And Senate File 2500 goes to the floor.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you very much, Chairman Lurie. We appreciate it. Senator Arrest, thank you very much.
Members, we're going to be taking up Senate File 2401 in just a moment. As I indicated, there has been a great deal of interest in this topic of judicial selection, and we had an informational hearing with the Committee on Judiciary before session, so the topic should be familiar to people. Because of that, this is not an informational hearing, and we will ask people to limit their testimony. Senator Lurie will be chairing the committee as I present the bill, and he will keep people to 5 minutes apiece, and so we would ask you to respect other people who are talking and also to respect the members' time this afternoon by keeping your remarks brief and at no case any longer than 5 minutes. And Senator Lurie has his watch out.
Thank you for that introduction to Senate File 2401 on judicial selection. We can begin by having you describe the bill.
Mr. Chairman, I have two amendments, both of them author's amendments. One is the lead all, and then a second amendment is an amendment to the lead all amendment. So to begin with, before I start on my description of the bill, A4 amendment.
Senator Rust offers the A4 author's amendment. All in favor? Aye.
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 Opposed? Motion carries.
Mr. Chairman, I would offer the A5 amendment.
Do we have that in our pack? Okay.
It's coming.
Senator Rust, to
you ready?
Put the bill in the shape she would like to carry it. Also offers the author's amendment A5. All in favor? Aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. We now have the bill in shape. You can step us through it.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senate File 2401, first of all, proposes an amendment to the Minnesota Constitution regarding the way in which judges are to hold office. The question that is, or what will be put into the Constitution, is that each judge will hold office for a term. I'm reading it from section 7 of the Constitution. For a term ending on December 31st following the next regularly scheduled general election held more than 3 years after the appointment. After that, the terms would be 8 years. and the until a successor is appointed, and there would be a selection commission to make recommendations to the governor on all judges, and also a performance evaluation commission to evaluate the performance of the judge in a nonpartisan manner, and then the judge would stand for a retention election. The question to be submitted to the voters is, shall the Minnesota Constitution be amended to provide that judges shall be appointed by the governor from a list of names submitted by a selection commission, evaluated based on performance before standing for a retention election to the office, and then retained or removed regularly based on a decision by the voters? The question is proposed to be submitted to the voters in the November 2008 election. That is a summary of Article 1. Article 2 begins to amend the statutory provisions to address the retention elections and the kind of election this is. So in Section 1, it makes it a technical correction, in a sense, to indicate that ballot questions do not include a judicial retention election. In Section 2, we expand the definition of candidate to include a judge standing for retention in a judicial office. In Section 3, election now also applies to not just a primary, special primary, general or special, but also a retention election. In Section 4, the requirements for filing for office are now applied to judges who would be filing for a retention, who would be a retention candidate. In Section 5, it refers to the notice of election, which would state the name of each judge or justice or judge, again, seeking retention. So it's making many of these changes are just to include the notion of a retention election. In Section 6, it's making clear that these ballots where judges would stand for a retention election are only in a general election. In Section 7, the judges are also would come under, for the retention election, the time period that is established by 204B09, which is the time and place of filing for office, and that it would be a nonpartisan designation in the form that is currently prescribed by law. What happens in an election? Well, if the majority of those voting on this question only of their retention, not in the whole election, so it's not like a constitutional amendment itself, but if a majority of those voting on the vote on the question votes no, then when the term of that judge expires, he or she is removed from office and a vacancy shall exist. If a majority of those voting on the question vote yes, then the judge remains in office for that that 8-year term, subject to removal under other provisions of the Minnesota Constitution. Also, in this section, we provide that a judge who loses a retention election shall be ineligible to be nominated to fill the resulting vacancy. So if in a performance evaluation, for example, the Performance Evaluation Commission says that a judge is unqualified and the voters agree and vote no on the question of shall this judge be retained, then that judge cannot be go through the same process once again to fill the resulting vacancy that occurs because he or she loses the retention election. A judge who is seeking to retain judicial office shall be considered a candidate for election to that office. And once again, we specify that this is not a ballot election. Section 8 speaks to Section 480B01, Subdivision 11, which is the way in which nominees are sent to the governor under the current judicial selection, merit selection process. There is a 60-day requirement, and the Second Amendment addresses, makes it clear that it is not from the occurrence but after. Is that correct, Mr. Bottom? Yes. So on line 414, it would be with the amendment now in the bill, it reads within 60 days after the occurrence. And when that phrase occurs again, the word after is inserted. So the process would be that the commission would recommend after a vacancy, they have 60 days to recommend three nominees to the governor. Those names would be made public. The governor would appoint, must appoint from that list one of the persons or none of the persons. If he appoints none of the persons, then the selection commission once again would submit, would have 60 days to submit a an additional three names. The if you look at lines 423 through 425, if the commission does not submit a list of nominees within the required time frame, like within 60 days, then the governor may appoint anyone who is qualified to that vacancy without consulting the commission. The current judicial merit selection group is consists of 13 people. Seven are appointed at large by the governor, who one of whom is to be chair. The justices of the Supreme Court appoint two at large, who serve four-year terms. The appointments of the governor are at his pleasure. The governor then also appoints two members for each judicial district and two members, I guess it's a larger group than that. Two members, it's not 13. And two members, and the justices appoint two members for each judicial district. Section 9 sets up a commission on appellate judicial selection that is composed of 11 members. The members, just like the members of the Judicial Merit Selection Commission, must be residents of the state. They may not be, to serve on the commission, you may not be a public official, it is defined in Section 10A01, Subdivision 35, while a member of the commission. Section 10A, Subdivision 01, Subdivision 35 specifies that a public official is a member of the legislature, it is employees of the legislature, it is state agency heads, it is any number of named positions within state government. Public official makes no reference, however, to someone who has a locally elected, for the purposes of 10A, who is locally elected. It is so it does not apply to a school board member or a city council member or a township officer. These are all offices or officials at the state level and does not mean necessarily an elected official. Many of them, other than the constitutional officers and the and legislators, are in appointed positions or they are employees hired by the legislature. Members of the commission who are attorneys have to have been practicing, admitted to practice before the Supreme Court for not less than 5 years. Members are eligible for reappointment to up to two additional full terms, and members who would otherwise be eligible to hold judicial office may not be considered or appointed to fill a judicial vacancy while they are members of the commission, and there's also a cooling off period for 1 year following the end of their membership on the commission. The commission members are made up of the following. The governor may appoint five members or shall appoint five members, one of whom would be the commission chair. The gubernatorial appointees also will serve on the commission until the governor who makes the appointment leaves office or for a term of 4 years, whichever comes first. So though their terms are no coterminous with that of the governor. The Chief Justice for this particular commission has the Supreme Court shall appoint two members of the commission, and his or her appointees would serve on the commission for a four-year term. I would point out to you that in 480, currently in 480, for the judicial merit selection, the Chief Justice is not named as a single individual. Instead, the phrase is used, justices of the Supreme Court. But it doesn't, in that section of the law, as we have found in trying to rationalize commissions throughout the statutes, it doesn't give a process by which, statutorily at least, by which the Supreme Court justice would go about, what process they would go about making those appointments. It doesn't mean that there couldn't be a process or that the Chief Justice shouldn't be compelled to do it with in consultation with the Supreme Court. But in this bill draft, it only names the Chief Justice. In number three under sub two, the legislature is also will play a hand in the appointment of the members of the commission. In the original report and in the original draft of the bill, we only had the governor and the Supreme Court making appointments to this commission. Objection was raised that the, in terms of checks and balances, that the legislature should also play a role. And so each of the legislative leaders has a has an appointment. But instead of being for four terms, the length of term is only for 2 years, and that is to reflect the potential change in leadership over at each time the House of Representatives is elected, and at least at one point where the Senate only stands for a 2 year term. Paragraph B lists the duties of the appointing authorities as they are considering the appointments regarding the diversity of the state's population, as well as balanced geographic representation, and the I think the primary consideration of appointing individuals of outstanding competence and reputation. Under paragraph C, I mentioned that under the judicial merit selection, the governor's appointees serve at the pleasure of the governor. Under this appellate commission, the members may be removed by an appointing by the appointing authority at any time, first of all, for cause after notice and hearing, and, interestingly enough, attendance. If you're going to be part of this group, you got to be there. So if you miss three meetings, the appointing authority may remove that meeting member after giving notice to the person if they've missed two meetings, two consecutive meetings, and notifying them that their possibility that they would be removed if they missed a third consecutive meeting. Subdivision 3. And this is another time where the word after substitutes for from. This commission will also be submitting to the governor after a 60-day period when a vacancy has been declared a list of names for the governor to consider, and the same process is followed. Also, in paragraph B, the duties of the commission with regard to the qualifications of the person to be nominated are directed. In section 10, the performance commission is set up, and it is again established in the judicial branch. After public hearings, the commission will adopt and administer for all judges this process for evaluating judicial performance. The commission is made up of 25 members. Once again, all members must be residents of Minnesota at the time of their appointment and for as long as their term lasts. Once again, the commissioner may not be a public official. Under 10A01-35 while a member of the commission. And members who are attorneys must have been admitted to practice before the Supreme Court. And members may be eligible for reappointment for two terms. The makeup of the commission is as follows. The governor would appoint 9 members, and they would serve or coterminous with the governor, or until the governor leaves office, whichever comes first. The Chief Justice would have appointments for 8 members, and his appointments are limited to individuals who are sitting or former Minnesota State Court judges. And on this commission, the performance evaluation, it is the Chief Justice's responsibility to select one of his appointees to serve as the commission chair. They, too, would serve a 4-year term, not coterminous with the governor, however, but just a 4-year term. The legislative appointees number 8, and they are to be made in order in 2 rounds, starting with the Speaker of the House, then the Majority Leader of the Senate, then the Minority Leader of the House, and then the Minority Leader of the Senate. Again, these terms, for obvious reasons, as with the Selection Commission, are appointees for a 2-year term. Members are... what their duties are and what their obligations are explained in paragraph C, D, and E. And then in case there is a vacancy, the way in which the appointing authority has the ability to appoint a person to fill the vacancy for the remainder of that particular unexpired term. Subdivision 3 calls for all meetings of the Judicial Performance Commission to be subject to the open meeting law. The judicial exemption in Minnesota Statutes 1390 notwithstanding. The duty of the commission, its authority, is to develop written standards. This is sub 4 now on page 7, subject to approval by the Supreme Court, by which judicial performance is to be evaluated. The commission is called upon to periodically update the standards, and they must include knowledge of the law, procedure, integrity, impartiality, et cetera. The commission may not evaluate, however, judicial performance based on substantive legal issues or opinions that are subject to standard appellate processes. The commission must require public comment. The hearing shall be conducted on the performance of all judges prior to a final determination as to whether a judge meets or does not meet the judicial performance standards. There are 2 times when a judge would be evaluated. One is midway through a judge's term, and then the second time is no fewer than 9 months before the judge would stand for election. The Supreme Court is given the authority to adopt a rule that would establish standards for a survey, which would be part of the performance evaluation. The survey would be sent to a representative sample of attorneys, litigants, judges, other persons who have been in direct contact with a judge or with each judge, and who have direct knowledge of the judge's performance during that period. The Performance Commission may contract with a vendor to prepare the survey forms, et cetera. People who are asked to respond to the survey may also submit narrative comments. The midterm evaluation, the purpose of that is to evaluate a judge halfway through his term in order to offer advice on and to give the judge an opportunity for improvement. The final evaluation is the one that would be given prior to a judge standing for the retention election, and and with it would come public comment and a designation that the judge would be qualified or unqualified. The original report said that those words would appear on the ballot, and Representative Simon and I thought that that was a bit of a reach, and we removed them, and they do not appear in the bill. In Subdivision 8, we describe the evaluation panel itself. As you recall, the total number of people on the Performance Commission is 25. A panel of five members of the commission would be actually doing the work of the evaluation. It would include at least one member of appointed by each branch of government. So there would be one appointee from the Supreme Court, one appointee from the governor, one appointee from the legislature, and then the other two would be chosen randomly. A district judge who serves as a panel member may not evaluate one of his or her peers who sits in the same judicial district. Then the panel makes its report to the full commission. The full commission reviews that panel's evaluation if the panel declares a judge unqualified. Or if one panelist or three members of the commission request a review. So there's a lot of review of the work done by the initial panel. One would expect, however, that the judges are going, for the most part, probably 95-98% of them are going to be designated as qualified, and the full commission would seldom be called upon to act. But there is this kind of appeal to a decision that is made by the five-member panel, and the circumstances under which that review of the five-member panel would take place are in paragraph. Paragraph B on page 9, then, and in section 10, indicates that if the valuation is to be reviewed by the full commission, that it will provide notice to the affected judge, and that the affected judge would have the right to submit written comments to the commission and to appear and be heard before them. The Subdivision 9 provides for the publication of the evaluation results 1 month before the time period that is established in the election law for filing an affidavit of candidacy. Subdivision 10, the rulemaking authority is given to this commission. Section 11 indicates that the judicial retention election shall be conducted consistent with the procedures that are in current law with regard to the administration of state general elections. The Section 12 forbids service on both commissions by a single individual and allows for a member of the commission to serve until a successor has been appointed. Section 13 calls for participation by electronic means in meetings called by the Performance Commission, and this is pretty boilerplate language that also has been used in other instances for meetings of commission commissions or advisory groups. Section 14 has been amended by the A5 amendment so that it is all appointing authorities are required to make their judicial appointments to this commission no later than 90 days before adoption, and that the chair of the commission, of each commission, by the way, each commission, both the appellate judicial selection commission and the performance commission, must the chair must call the first meeting of those commissions no later than 30 days after all of the members of the commission are appointed. So that is a description of the bill. People, I'm not going to testify in a sense on my own bill. There are a lot of people here to testify on it. I do want to thank in particular the Bar Association for some really good suggestions, particularly the panel in the performance evaluation, right and good insistence on the performance evaluation being subject to the open meeting law, and the suggestion of including the third branch of government in the appointees in these two commissions. I must say that in the minority report for the CUI Commission, the Bar Association also thought that they ought to have a role in appointing members to this these commissions, but they are not included in this delete all amendment. So, Mr. Chairman, if people have, you know, questions for information, I can certainly answer those now, and then we could go to the testimony.
Yes, I've got one just clarification question about our packets. The probably for counsel, is the summary of the bill handed out regarding the bill as drafted or at the amendment, the delete all amendment?
Mr. Chairman, that is an error. It is, in fact, drafted to the delete all amendment.
I thought so.
Current.
Okay, good.
And
so
then,
this is
and
a
then,
good description.
But, Mr. Chairman, the summary is drafted to the delete all amendment, but not to the without amendment to the delete all amendment.
Without the
so
A5 amendment.
We would need to,
okay,
to change that.
So just so everybody can follow along. I know I use those quite a bit. Senator Betzel.
Sure. And, Senator Rest, I do have a technical question regarding the commission members, Judicial Performance Commission. It's this 25-member commission. I think it's possible that some of the appointees, possibly by the governor and the legislature, maybe by the chief justice, you know, might get into a situation that may be perceiving a conflict of interest. You may have some, for instance, if the legislature appoints one of its members and that person's a lawyer and that person happens to have had practice, you know, before a particular judge who is under consideration, that member of the commission may say, geez, you know, I just don't feel like I'm qualified, or I don't want to be weighing in on this particular one. Mm-hmm. Would the intention be that the person would just recuse himself or herself, or be substituted if need be? Since there is no provision to replace, I'm just assuming the person would have to sit it out.
Senator Rest.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Betzel, that's a very good point, and I would assume they would recuse themselves, and then someone else would be either chosen as another one of those would be chosen as the replacement for the appointing authority and or chosen randomly from the two that would be chosen randomly. I don't know that if a a reference to a statute on conflict of interest would take care of that, but it might take a little bit more language than just sitting here in this committee to address a conflict of interest in that regard. But it's a very good point, and I would I think that kind of change should be made, just for clarification in terms of relationship between the commission members and the person being evaluated.
Senator Betzel.
And Mr. Chair, just a unrelated issue, but I spent the last couple of months trying to work on a Supreme Court commission to review and rewrite the rules in the Board of Judicial Standards, which is an executive agency board but has the authority to discipline judges. And obviously, I would think that some of the information that they have, if it's public information, would probably be considered by the commission, but not everything is public. And in fact, you know, for some very good reason, sometimes complaints are filed against judges and they're unfounded, and sometimes the judge never finds out about it. Well, obviously, there's no reason why the commission would need to see that, but sometimes there are complaints against a judge that are handled, you know, or at least on the proposed rules, with a private reprimand or something like that. And I'm not quite sure if, you know, if there's going to be any intersection between what the Board of Judicial Standards does and what this commission does, because obviously, you know, if a judge has had some disciplinary actions, even if they're never public, but that would sort of undermine the whole process of the private reprimands. So I don't know how the two would work, if at all.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Senator Chairman Rest. And Senator Betzel, I certainly will also take a look at that, of that relationship, and to make sure that there is no conflict or as little conflict between their two roles as possible as it affects an individual judge.
Any other questions of members before we get to testimony? Senator Roebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Rest, there is no provision in here, is there, that would require that the governor's appointments be confirmed by the Senate?
Senator Rest.
No. Mr. Chairman and Senator Roebling, no, the governor's appointments are made under his own authority with no advice and consent.
Mr. Chair?
Senator
Roebling. Just as in the Judicial Merit Selection Commission now, they're not. They serve at his pleasure.
I guess I have a little bit of a concern, and I know it's not a long period of time, but it's a little different than a legislator who doesn't have a lot of control. If they're rejected by the voters and they serve out their term till the end of the year, usually they can't do much damage if they're really upset about something. On the other hand, a judge who makes individual rulings could potentially do some unusual things after they know they're losing their job because they've been rejected by the voters. And I'm just wondering if it's wise to leave them till the end of their term or if they should be dismissed after the election.
Mr. Watson or Mr. Bodern can correct me, but I think under the current system, when a judge is defeated by another candidate, I don't know at what point they lose their job when they stand for re-election. Do they have their job until the end of the year?
Mr. Watson?
Well, Mr. Chairman, Senator Rest, yes, they have their job until the end of the term. Mm-hmm.
Until the end of the term.
They might be called a lame duck at that point.
And so, Mr. Chairman and Senator Roebling, we're not making any change in that. And although concern about that should be present now as well as under this system, but it's no different.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Roebling.
Senator Rest, I guess that normally the lame ducks in Congress or in the legislature just can't do a whole lot of mischief because they have to have a majority ruling with them. But a district court judge or somebody who doesn't have to have a panel of judges with them could potentially cause some mischief.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Rumling, they can do that right now.
Right. But maybe that's not a good idea. We have so few judges that lose elections
That's
now.
That's correct.
That I guess we haven't seen much precedent established on that.
And Mr. Chairman and Senator Roebling, I think the even though the goal here is to take partisanship out of selection of judges, to take raising money in your own name, knowing who your contributors are, out of the judicial selection, curbing somewhat freedom of speech for candidates for judge in the name of justice for the people, that it seems to me that's warranted.
Senator Betzold.
Hey, Mr. Chair, and I'll pose a question, and I imagine maybe some of the witnesses may be addressing this too, but under the present system right now, if a judge files for reelection and the filing periods close and that judge is the only one who's filed for that particular spot, I think the judge can pretty much rest assured that it's probably he's going to win. It's no contest. And I think theoretically there could be a write-in, but, you know, if only one person filed, that's it. However, with a retention election, it's my understanding that the judge doesn't know. I mean, it's going to be up to the voters. My name will be on the ballot to retain or not retain. And should not there be an incentive for the judge to do the fundraising and raise some money? Because you don't know if something's going to pop out of the weeds 2 weeks before the election. And if you haven't done anything to prepare for that, you might be caught short. And all of a sudden, you're not retained and you can't get reappointed and you're really out. So wouldn't the retention elections cause the judges to now do the fundraising and everything that a lot of them don't need to do right now?
Senator Rust.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I think you will hear from the witnesses who will address that. And certainly we had the testimony from the district court judges who seemed, not all of them, by the way, but in fact a good number support the new system, that to respond to that. And I just point out in members' packets comments from District Court Judge Dave Knutson, former state senator Dave Knutson, in his judicial district surveyed the judges, and I believe it of 36, 26 replied, and 21 of those said that they favored the retention election, and you have in your packets resolutions from the 7th and 8th judicial districts supporting the principles that are in Senate File 2401. So I think there are a number of judges that would not have the fear in terms of the type of election and how they must prepare for it, that the benefits of a retention election far outweigh the negative consequences of the type of election that we have now following White.
Senator Gimsey.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Rest, I'm still somewhat unclear about the Judicial Selection Committee and you know, where they come with three nominees for the governor, and the governor doesn't like, say, any one of those three. They go back and select three more. My question is there a period in time where the nominees don't have to come through the selection committee process and the governor can just go ahead and appoint?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Gimsey, there is a 60-day turnover period in which the commission comes up with three members, and then the governor can appoint after that or within that 60-day period. If he chooses to reject them, they get another 60 days to, and that cycle keeps on. If, however, the commission fails to come up with a list of three nominees during that period, on the 61st day, the governor may select whomever he chooses, as long as that person is qualified under the Constitution.
Senator Gimsey.
Okay, so my understanding is correct that the selections for these judges have to come through the selection committee. There is no other than that, and I realize that there will always be three nominees, but say the governor had a particular person in mind and was unable to get that person into the selection process or through the selection committee. Would that governor would not have the option then to have that person?
Mr. Chairman and Senator pressed. Gimsey, no, he would not, and he doesn't have it now under the current judicial merit selection in 480B for district court judges. And so the process for the appellate court judge selection is mirrored by the one that's currently in place for the district court judges, and it's that 60-day period with then three nominees, choose one or none, another 60-day period. If they don't come through, then the governor gets to choose and select anyone he chooses as long as that person is qualified under the Constitution.
Okay. Thank you, Senator Rist.
Any other questions of members? Okay, Senator Rust, you can call your supporting witnesses.
Well, Mr. Chairman, you can just read their names.
Just go right through. Al Cui, former governor of Minnesota, welcome to the committee.
We'll remind everyone again, 5 minutes.
Yes, a five-minute rule. Ready? No.
And, Mr. Chairman, I think I'll come back and sit at the table, and maybe to facilitate things, we could have two people come up at a time.
Sure.
All the way through.
Roger Moe, former Senate Majority Leader. State your name for the record. Okay.
Thank you, Chairman Lurie and members of the committee, and thank you, Senator Rest, for the work that you did for authoring this bill and improving on the recommendation as you've done. I mean, that's tremendous. There's two human motivations in judges. One of them just comes out of the literature for thousands of years and all the way to the present time, is that there seems to be a moral law inside people that they want impartiality on the part of the judge. So the literature talks about unjust judges and just judges and all that. But there's another motivation, and that is we'd like judges to decide according to our view. And so those things are struggling right now with this one. And as we all realize that 10% of the judges get picked by the voters, and better than 90% by the governor, and not more than about 10% get an opponent at the time when their term expires. And so that's where we're faced. And so as we look at these, the three major principles, what we're about, and the one is that the voters do have an opportunity to decide the continuance of every judge who stands wants to continue for another term. It's different than the present time, where on those 90% who don't have an opponent, the voters have nothing to say about that. And the second part of it is the public performance evaluation. Public performance evaluation only operates where there are retention elections. Every time else there's none, or else and it's private. And so instead of people coming to ask you who should they vote for judge, they will be able to provide for them the information on that judge performed. And then the last one, they'll all be selected by the merit selection system. And so when we look at the states now, and you look at both the American Judicature Society and the Chamber of Commerce, who evaluate the states, there are no partisan election states in either of their ratings in the top 10. But there are a number of partisan election states in the worst ones. Also, when you look at the polling that we did in Minnesotans for Impartial Courts, it was Justice Stake that did it and provided the information that we saw, and that is that given to the people, they have a choice between going ahead now with the opportunity for partisan campaigns versus a retention election. There were 8% that supported continuing where we are now, and 67% wanted to go to the retention elections. So if you wonder how one's constituents are going to react. Now, I heard the comments here, and I just want to talk about a little bit about what I've heard said. There is a fear when you go into something, and you would expect that anybody, when you have moved where you have a good chance at 90% chance that nobody will run against you, and now, you're running against a perfect person. But it isn't true. And so when you look at Wisconsin, where they've gone to partisan elections now, the last campaign in 2007 was $6 million, and now they're running another one that they expect to be $10 million. But you look at another neighbor of Minnesota, Iowa, and not a cent has been spent in the last 5 years. And so as for the lame duck doing something wrong, I imagine every human being is worried about their legacy. We still remember the governor who pointed outside of the recommendation of the commission. Human beings want to be looked at with some favor after they leave. And also now on the selections, bear in mind, you worry, can the governor go outside? This governor picks a number of the people on the selection commission. If those people are having some concern for the governor, and right now, 1 minute left?
Yep.
Okay, got it. Thank you. Yeah.
1 minute.
And so that I can go through the history of this and how difficult it is for the legislature to take action sometimes. Let me just tell you a story. I came out of our meeting at the Bar Association, got in my pickup truck, started backing out of the stall, and there was a clunk and a jar like I backed into somebody. I got out and looked, and there was nothing there. And I knew it was the transmission. I got in, moved it ahead slowly, moved it back, and it worked. I should have taken it to the shop, but I had a meeting. So I left on 394. A warning light came on. And then later on, before I got there, a flashing light came on, and it says, stop, idle your engine, something serious will happen to your automobile. So the white decision was the clunk. Wisconsin is the warning light, and the fact that the Republican Party is organizing now on judicial districts is the flashing red light, folks.
Thank you.
Did it my time.
Interesting use of your last minute. I appreciate it. Roger Moe, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Roger Moe. I'm here as a citizen, and I serve on some volunteer work on the advisory board of the Center for Study in Politics and Governance at the Humphrey Institute, and they have an interest, obviously, in this legislation and some others as well. I want to thank the committee for hearing this, Senator Rest, for your interest in this issue. I'm honored to be here with my friend, Governor Al Quie. I wished I could tell you some stories about what happened between he and I about 16, 17 years ago in this room. They're pretty good stories. But let me just say that I want to thank him for his work. Governor Quie, was the one who instituted the merit selection process for judges. It was followed by every governor after him and eventually put in statute. And had we not been faced with a terrible economy, which, by the way, makes your budget shortfalls pale and insignificant compared to what we dealt with back in late 80, 81, and 82, Governor Cui would have had his pre-K education programs in place and once again demonstrating the kind of vision that is evident here today. So we shouldn't be surprised that the governor is involved with this issue because he has had vision in other areas as well. I'm not going to give you the details like he has and Senator Rest. I'm going to look at it from my past and what kind of colors my view on this, and obviously my past is your present. Tomorrow, you have session tomorrow?
Yes.
Bring your laptops up on the floor, and I know that the debates are always stimulating, but take a minute out and Google campaign money in judicial elections and take a look. There'll be 214,000 hits will come up, or references. Now, that's probably not a big deal. But take a closer look at them. You will rarely see a reference, any story in the paper or anything, prior to the year 2000. There's one or two or a few. But starting in 2000, you start to see more and more references until many of them as of late. The trend line is like a hockey stick. That's the warning light that Governor Cui talked about. And they're all in a negative sense about additional campaigning, the money that goes into judicial elections. It doesn't bother me in the legislature. You folks get confronted all the time with constituency groups, special interests, whatever those are, all of the things that you get pressured on. But there's 67 of you in the Senate that have to somehow homogenize things and work it out. And then you have to work it out with another 134 across the street. And so it's hard, it generally, the amazing thing about the process is that what comes out at the other end is truly a pretty good reflection of the state. I don't think we want to have that situation with one person in charge. And that would be the case in the judicial elections. And it seems to me that if there's one thing that in this legislative body you ought to agree on, whether you're liberal or conservative or somewhere in between, and that's this, that the lawmaking part of government is yours, and you ought not to give up any part of it. That is the one thing that you want to protect vigorously. Now, I think in additional testimony today, you'll hear from somebody who will say that we ought not to amend the Constitution this way. Well, let me just point out that there have been 212 constitutional amendments offered since we became a state, not counting the one that you've got pending now for the next election, and over 10% of those amendments related to the court, over 10% of them. So I would suggest to you that you pass this, you put it on the ballot, and I would argue that you'll have a much better debate next fall on this amendment and about what we want for the future of our courts than you will on this other ballot the other amendment that you're going to have on the ballot. I think it's going to be a much better discussion and debate as the outcome. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Rest.
Before Justice Anderson speaks, I need to correct something that in my response to Senator Gimsey, which I'm sure all the judges in the room probably caught immediately, and that is under the current law with the district court judges, the governor uses the judicial selection, but he may make an appointment independent of it. And in the proposal, at every level, the governor needs to choose someone from the three nominees, or they have to go back and submit an additional slate of nominees, but it would not be for at any level independent of that. And I'm sorry that I didn't read that carefully enough, mm-hmm. and I didn't mean to be misleading.
Mm-hmm. I understand that. Thank you, Senator.
Roger Moe, if you could stay at the table. I think we're going to ask Governor Cui to come back up to the table. We're going to take Justice Anderson's testimony at 5 minutes, and then we'll ask questions of the three of you is what I was thinking.
Okay.
Take them three at a time.
You well, I'll sit there, Governor. I'll sit here on the corner. That's just fine. That's just fine. I'm happy to.
Can we take questions after three?
It's related.
Related to Senator Rest. Senator Roebling.
I know that they have to pick from that slate, but it does say in here, doesn't it, that if they don't provide a slate, the governor can just go ahead and appoint.
Mr. Chairman, that's correct. But under the current law for the district court judges, the governor can do it regardless of whether they submit a slate, and I was confusing the two.
Okay. Justice Barry Anderson, welcome to the committee. State your name for the record.
My name is Barry Anderson, Associate Justice of the Minnesota Supreme Court. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Let me begin with a couple of assumptions, and then I'm going to talk a little bit about what I'm going to visit with you about, and then I look forward to our dialogue and conversation about this issue. I first want to make clear that I speak only on behalf of myself, not on behalf of anyone else, and I'm not here to defend every detail or to articulate every detail of the precise bill and constitutional amendment that is before you. I'm going to talk generally about why I think this reform effort is helpful. I'm certainly willing to engage in dialogue on those details, but I wanted to make that clear. And then the second assumption that I want to highlight for you, and I think it is true for most of us, Governor Kui touched on this, and that is the assumption that we're all here today because we believe that judges should, in fact, be impartial. I used to think that was a given and that we all shared that belief. I think it is fair to say that there are some who don't, and there are some who believe that the judiciary is nothing more than another branch of a policymaking branch subject to the same kinds of campaigns and efforts that we see in the executive and legislative branches. I think there's a fundamental difference, and I want to be clear here that I'm not arguing that there's a qualitative difference or superiority. These are co-equal branches of government with very different functions. And I would argue that the judiciary has an adjudicative function, an obligation to decide questions of law and applying the facts to the law, and that's a very different function than is fulfilled by the other two co-equal branches of government. With those two assumptions in mind, I want to visit with you about three things. The future trend line that Senator Moe outlined, I want to talk briefly about retention elections, and I want to talk briefly about performance evaluation. Let me talk about the trend line. I begin with the observation that if I thought there was no chance that Minnesota would go the way other states have gone with respect to judicial elections, I would not be here today. In fact, I'd probably be on the other side, explaining why I don't think you should take any action, why we should reject any attempt to amend the Constitution. But I am not confident of that. In fact, I'm confident of the reverse. Why do I say that? Well, let's talk a little bit about what's been happening. In the four election cycles since 1999, $157 million has been spent in Supreme Court races, partisan, nonpartisan, and in a very limited extent, retention elections. That is twice the preceding four election cycles. We now have a situation in the state of Ohio, for example, where in the 2004 Supreme Court election cycle, 13,000 broadcast ads were seen on television and heard on radio. And it's interesting to note, one of the problems that you run into when you talk about this area is that of those broadcast ads, 11% were purchased by the candidates themselves. In fact, what you have are increasingly special interest groups and other groups funding these efforts independent of the candidate. By that I mean 527 groups, by that I mean political parties and others, specifically not coordinating with the candidate. It was interesting to hear Senator Moe talk about the year 2000. He's quite right as a breakpoint. In the year 2000, there were four states in Supreme Court races that had television ads. By 2004, we're talking 15 states. We're down to two states with partisan or nonpartisan elections, North Dakota and Minnesota, that have not experienced the wonders of television advertising and judicial campaigns. Now, why is that significant? You may be saying to yourself, it matters because the advertising is pointed at the direction of persuading the public either that a judge or justice has made up his mind about specific issues or that his opponent has made up his mind. And judges themselves, in a poll taken by Carnegie, 40% of the judges indicated, at least to some extent, they felt pressured by their campaign contributions. They felt judges were pressured by their campaign contributions. So if we're interested in an impartial judiciary, those trend lines are significant. That leads me to my second point. What about retention elections? Do they help? Do they deal with the problem? What does the number say there?
One minute.
The evidence indicates that they do. I can tell you that in the 2006 election cycle, over $30 million was spent in partisan and nonpartisan races. $1,000 was raised by one justice of the 34 who were subject to retention elections. And even if you add in a very expensive race in Pennsylvania in the preceding year, you're still talking about a qualitative difference. Those trend lines exist all across retention elections. They work elsewhere, they'll work here. And finally, with respect to performance evaluation, the one thing we hear from folks is we want more information about judges. And when you combine performance evaluation with the retention model, you find retention rates going up in places like Arizona and other places. So I think that when you evaluate all of these things together, you conclude that the recommendations that the Quay Commission made are sound and well worth your consideration. And it's on that basis that I come to you today and support them.
Thank you. I think with this esteemed panel of three, we'll start our first round of questions from members if they have any. Senator Roebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and maybe Justice Anderson. I'm wondering, in the states that have had retention elections and that have performance evaluations, have you any idea how many of those evaluations have indicated that a judge was not qualified?
It's rare, but it does happen. For example, perhaps once every other election cycle, every couple of election cycles, perhaps. What usually happens, at least this is the anecdotal information we've been given in these other states, judges that are potentially going to receive a negative evaluation, this is not something that comes out of the blue usually. I mean, these are focusing on objective criteria, things that are important in terms of performance, judicial performance, and the judge usually figures out that this is a good time maybe to pursue other career opportunities. And you never get quite to the down check stage, but it does happen.
Could I add one thing there?
Governor Quay.
And that is the quality that the judges who are sitting improve with this because they know they're going to be evaluated. That's why all kinds of people use performance evaluation, but you only give it to the people who are going to make the decision. In this case, it's the voters. That's why it needs to be made public. And so the studies have shown the quality of the judges goes up. That's why there are fewer that get that retention election. And you know that yourself. You acted differently when your parents were watching you. And that's the same way here.
Senator Marty.
Mr. Chair, I supported for many years Senator Neville's bill, and I was kind of getting persuaded by Governor Quay and others about, in effect, the majority report of the commission instead of the minority report. But I've been hearing from a number of, well, I've got a chart. I remember the 1986 Rose Byrd decision in California where the unseated three judges, it says here, $11.5 million campaign based on some decisions. Talks about case in Missouri in 2006 where a circuit judge was defeated after being targeted in the last week's retention election attack by a group called Citizens for Judicial Reform, funded by large contributions from a wealthy New York real estate investor upset with rulings of other Cole County judges. My question, and it's the one I had before, the reason I think I was leaning the direction of the minority report, I don't disagree at all with you about the risk of what happens if we don't change, but isn't this just giving people a hit list? It's a lot easier to run a campaign, vote for Justice Anderson and against Justice Anderson, vote for one Anderson against the other Anderson or Johnson against Anderson or whatever. It's a lot tougher to run a campaign and say that you got the incumbent on the ballot, name on the ballot, and that gives a lot of cover. And a judge or justice that's unopposed after the filing date knows they're going to be, they don't have to raise money, they don't have to do this. But with a lot of these cases, people come in the last few weeks of the campaign, the judge who's up for election on the hit list, in effect, is up at the last minute, and there's no way, so you have to prepare for it. I guess I'm just curious.
Well, first, Cole County, Missouri, is not a retention election county. It's a partisan election county. Missouri's got 114 counties, and only four of those counties do the trial court judges stand for at a retention election. All the rest of them are partisan elections. Now you look at Rose Byrd in California. Rose Byrd consistently went against the legislature and against the will of the people in an initiative of referendum. And she spent more money than her opponents did. Now, I think when that happens, that's the people deciding.
For the benefit of those trying to follow along, maybe you should take 1 minute and describe the minority report that has been...
Somebody can describe.
Mr. Chairman, Sanderson. Senator Marty, I would be happy to do that. There are actually two minority reports. One called for appointment and reappointment by a legislative commission, and I think the minority report that Senator Marty was referring to was actually based on Senator Neville's bill, which was introduced a couple of times, and that provided for legislative confirmation. And there have been different versions of that, confirmation and reconfirmation, but would end judicial elections and instead move the process of reconfirming judges for additional terms to either the Senate, the House, or both bodies, depending on what bill you might look at. And I want to respond to, because I think there are two concepts at work here, and they get mixed up. The first concept is the possibility of drive-by, last-minute attacks. There's relatively little evidence of this occurring. You hear Rose Byrd mentioned. You hear Penny White mentioned. Penny White is a justice in Tennessee who failed in a retention election. There was a justice in Pennsylvania. But in each of those cases, those candidates knew, there was advance warning of a race. Now, are there examples of the 30,000 judges who are elected in the United States in one form, or 30,000 judges, 87% of which are elected in one form or another, of a drive-by kind of, as you describe it? Sure, of course there are. And you're talking about a handful. But when you talk about partisan, nonpartisan elections, you're talking about a much, much larger number. And that's what we're worried about. The retention elections are not going to solve everything. They are, but if you look at the data in terms of the judges who are defeated, it's a smaller number. Now, keep in mind that we're not talking about preserving the jobs of any individual judge or justice. It's no great tragedy if the voters vote Barry Anderson out of office. If, coupled with a merit selection plan, whoever happens to be governor at that time appoints a qualified replacement. The idea is to keep the special interest groups from being able to raise large sums of money to put their candidate on the court, who then has, at least in the public perception, a bias in favor of or a bias against the litigants who appear in that courtroom.
Senator Marty.
Mr. Chairman, Justice Anderson, it was on that point that I was coming around to the majority report, but the concern is that often the groups are out to get a judge. They don't have to replace them with somebody they like. They just have to send a message to the other judges. Mm-hmm. And, again, this list, I don't know if this came from judges or who it came from, but it talks about 1996, Nebraska justice was unseated over several decisions, mainly interpretation of murder statute. Campaign against him announced less than 2 months before the election. Says campaign was calculated attempt to influence future Supreme Court decisions. Says there were no 1998 election challenge because Supreme Court handed down no controversial decisions since the race in 96. In fact, they undid their interpretation of the murder statute that Lamphere had supported and was challenged on. That, to me, and again, whether this is a fair characterization, what happened there, I don't know anything mm-hmm. about it. But it seems to me the other issue is not just can we get somebody on the bench that we like, but is it, can we intimidate other judges to shy away from something that they believe because they're going to be challenged if they don't do it?
Justice Anderson.
Thank you, Madam or Mr. Chairman and Senator Marty. My response to that would be to say, yes, you can find some examples of that, and yes, it is entirely possible that groups might have in mind intimidation. But it's not going to work very effectively if we're talking about the relatively small numbers. I mean, we're talking out of 6,000 judges subject to retention elections since the early 1980s, we're talking about 60 that have been defeated. That includes Supreme Court justices, district court judges. It's a very small group. Now, does the potential exist? Yes. In terms of the alternative, I mean, there are really two alternatives to the retention model, it seems to me. One is some form of legislative confirmation, and it's not clear to me that that is a less political model than a retention election model. I think that's a subject for another discussion. Or the federal model, permanent lifetime appointments. And without getting into the merits and lack of merits and all of that kind of discussion, I think one of the problems you run into is the fact that the public is very resistant to giving up, so to speak, their right to vote. The polling data that some of you have seen indicates that the public is supportive, generally, of retention election states, and it's interesting that you don't see retention election states moving away to different models. You see these conversations in states like Minnesota, in partisan and nonpartisan election states, who are worried about or already have the problem we're discussing. So these are trend lines. Your point is well taken, Senator Marty. I would not dispute it for a moment. But that's, you know, that's the price of living in a society with the First Amendment and rights of association and rights of free speech. And I think we do the best we can. And it's my judgment, looking at all of these possibilities, that the possibility that best addresses these issues and is best consistent with the public's desires and wishes is some form of merit selection, gubernatorial appointment, retention election, and performance review.
Thank you. Understanding that we have limited time, I'd like to try to move on to the next set, and we'll have plenty more opportunities for questions if members are willing. So Keisha Gaskin, Lucy Weiland, Justice Lucy Weiland, and Brian, Judge Lucy Weiland, and Brian Ruisch. Still going. Okay. The committee. State your name for the record and offer your testimony.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Chairman. My name is Keisha Gaskins. I'm the Executive Director for the League of Women Voters. As you're aware, the League of Women Voters is a nonpartisan political organization that encourages the informed and active participation of citizens' government. The League has stated its position, and we are in support of 2401. I feel honored to be sitting here before this committee and in such distinguished company. But what I'm most honored about is the fact, as I sit here, I represent one of the few grassroots organizations that has organized and spoken out on this issue. The League has spent almost a year, 9 months, studying this issue. And once we undertook to study the issue, we spoke with members of the Minnesota Supreme Court, the Minnesota Court of Appeals, both Republican DFL parties, the Minnesota State Bar Association, the United States District Court, members of the legislature, and members of the Commission on Judicial Selection. After studying this issue for 9 months, generating a report, which I believe all of you should have copies of, the League of Women Voters then distributed our report statewide to our 42 local leagues around the state of Minnesota, and then the local leagues did their own independent study of the report and then voted. When the league's position came out, it was unheard of. We had a 99% response rate in favor of the retention election program. The league has never had this kind of response before on a position. The League of Women Voters, and I'll be honest, I haven't been with the league that long, but I will say these women are not pushovers. They spend a lot of time really doing a lot of independent work. And as a consequence, the fact that you have independent people statewide who care very deeply about judicial independence, the league's reputation is long for caring very much about what goes on. And the league has said this is what we need in Minnesota. The league believes that this system strikes an appropriate balance between voter accountability and judicial independence. There is no question that this will not quell First Amendment. This isn't going to attack the right of people to speak out. But what it does do is minimize the motivations of 527s, of special interest groups, of political parties to try and involve and inject themselves into the process. And I know that you all have had a lot of testimony on this issue, but we really did want to point out that we really care a lot, and we don't believe that this is going to end up with a situation with qualified judges being removed but it does allow the voters their right to choose. And as we know, the League is very, very concerned with the rights of voters, and we really believe in judicial independence, and it is our belief that this strikes the appropriate balance. Thank you.
Thank you. Yes. Judge Weiland.
Thank you, Senator Lurie, members of the committee. My name is Lucy Wieland, and I'm the chief judge of the Hennepin County District Court, which is the fourth judicial district. I was a member of the Citizens Commission. I was one of two district judges on the commission. The other was Judge Jim Houlihan, who was at the time the president of the Minnesota District Judges Association. I was also a member of the minority group. And I guess I want to start by saying that although there was a majority and minority report, the two groups, actually everybody on the commission, agreed on most of the critical issues before us. And the first of those was that the expensive, negative, partisan election campaigns that simply are a reality in the post-white world threatened the integrity of the courts, and they threatened the confidence of the citizens of Minnesota in our courts. The second thing that everybody agreed on was that we needed to reform our judicial selection system to prevent that from happening. And we even agreed on three of the four critical elements of that system, the new one that we were discussing. The first of those was merit selection. I think everybody agrees with that. The second was that there would be appointment by the governor. The third would be that there would be performance evaluation of sitting judges. It was then at the fourth stage that there was disagreement, and that was whether or not there would be retention elections or whether there would be retention or removal by a commission that would be appointed as set out by statute. I think what became clear over the last few months is that retaining the vote of the people is a critical element of any judicial selection process in Minnesota. And many of us in the minority position understand that, and we respect it. And so I'm here today as a member of that original minority group to say that I'm in favor of the retention election model that you're considering today. While it wasn't my first choice, I think it's certainly preferable to partisan contested elections that we've seen in other states. And first, I just want to – I'm going to try, in the interest of time, just make three points and make them fairly quickly. The first is that, you know, I do disagree with people who say we should wait for the problem to happen, and I know there's talk of that. There's been a $6 million election campaign, as you heard, in 2007 in our neighboring state of Wisconsin, and I know that's been a wake-up call for many of us. Our court staff came back after the precinct caucuses last week with some pretty inflammatory material about judges in the courts and elections, and I think this is coming. I think it's dangerous. And Justice Anderson, I think, said it best in sum. You know, he said, once special interest groups gain a foothold, once the culture changes, once the dialogue becomes poisoned, it's going to be very, very hard to turn back the clock. And for that reason, I think it is important we move forward with this. The second point I want to make is that judges, district court judges, are not united on this, and they're never going to reach consensus. I know you're going to hear from the Minnesota District Judges Association and some other judges that they're opposed to retention elections. I think the really accurate thing we can say about the district judges in Minnesota is that some are opposed to retention elections, some are in favor of retention elections, and some of them, like good judges, want to wait and see what the final bill looks like before they make up their mind. You know, in a recent survey by the MDJA, 60% of the judges who responded did say they believed that we needed to change something because the post-white world was going to be threatening to the impartiality of the judiciary. This is a personal issue for judges, and it's a very, very difficult issue. And at the risk of the ire of my colleagues, it was said a few times during the commission, what judges think about this really isn't relevant. What's important here is what's best for the judiciary as a branch of government and what's best for the citizens of Minnesota. And I think that there are many judges in the state who agree with that. And, you know, I just wanted to point out, you've got it in your packets, within the last week, the judges in the 1st District, the 7th District, and the 8th District all voted by significant margins in two of those districts, actually unanimous in one of them, in favor of retention elections. And I think we're going to see more of this because I think that the threat of the post-white world is great. I want to quickly talk about this issue of drive-by shooting, so to speak. That is the best argument. I made that argument myself repeatedly during the commission meetings. I think it's a very legitimate argument. But I want to talk about the best check on that, and that is the Judicial Performance Evaluation Commission. That hasn't gotten perhaps as much talk as it should. I have a very good friend in Maricopa County, Arizona. I went to law school with her, and she's a judge down there, and that's the system they have. The Judicial Performance Evaluation Commission is extremely highly respected. It is very strong. It does thorough evaluations, and then, and most importantly, it very aggressively publicizes the results of that evaluation. And what happens down there is precisely what Justice Anderson said. The judges who do a poor evaluation, they're called in, and they know this, and they don't choose to run. It doesn't happen a lot, but it happens periodically. And I do think that this process of performance evaluation, it focuses the public debate on where it should be. It's on judges' performance. It holds judges accountable to the public on those things they should be accountable on, and it keeps politics out of the election. And I think that's the direction Minnesota needs to go. Thank you very much.
Brian Roush.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Brian Rushi, Joint Religious Legislative Coalition. And we support Senate File 24-1, and thank Senator Rest for bringing it to the body. The boards of the four groups that make up my coalition, the Minnesota Council of Churches, the Minnesota Catholic Conference, the Jewish Community Relations Council, and the Islamic Center of Minnesota, have all passed a position paper in favor of this model that would use merit selection, gubernatorial appointment, public evaluation commission, and retention elections. And they did it very expeditiously. And I think it's because we feel so strongly that there is this looming threat to what has been sort of the jewel of Minnesota government, the impartiality of our courts. They worked quickly. They came onto our radar last summer when a couple of district judges approached Lutheran Bishop John Anderson in the southwestern part of the state and kind of put it on his radar, and he brought it to JRLC and to the Minnesota Council of Churches. We immediately went to school by looking at the proceedings of the CUI Commission and the study groups of the League of Women Voters, both of which were just extremely well done and valuable in terms of bringing in all the players and having open discussions and open debate and complete with minority reports, and et cetera. We also then looked at some of the research at the Brennan Center at New York University about the pattern of spending in certain kinds of races and noticed immediately that there's just, you know, by factors of 100, you know, far less spending on retention elections than there are in the partisan races. And so we then looked at that information and held it up against some religious principles. And Governor Cui alluded to the great Christian parable about the unjust judge and about how we just immediately know when there's some unfairness about a judge not listening to somebody because they don't have social standing. We also looked at some of the very old stories. In fact, in Exodus, when Moses is overwhelmed by the number of cases brought before him for deciding, that was the first time a judiciary was impaneled, and it was his father-in-law, Jethro, that kind of laid out some standards for what a judge should be all about. And it had to do very much with impartiality and love of justice and, interestingly enough, untainted by money. It's clear in our traditions that there's this need to have people making rulings and judicial decisions that are not influenced by money. So all of this collective information was persuasive to us, and we acted, as I said, probably quicker on this issue than we have on anything since I've been around, and I've been doing this for 19 years. I think one of the things that we have going for us in Minnesota right now is the current climate. We have a very high confidence in our judiciary in Minnesota, and the polling shows that people, I think, are very much interested in having a say through the elections. Recent polling shows that 74% have confidence in our courts. 77% of Minnesotans are concerned about a situation where judicial candidates will have to raise more money and what that would mean. And 81% support judicial evaluation by a commission. So we think that this combination of current high confidence levels, support for this kind of model, will give us a system where retention election should be able to work. I think it's going to be really difficult for an interest group to raise money against a particular judge when they know that they aren't necessarily going to get what they want. It's going to default back to a vacancy, and then the judicial selection, merit selection process, and the gubernatorial appointment will take place. Also, I think the public is ready to is just very ready to smell money that's trying to inappropriately influence a judicial election, because we don't have that kind of scenario right here now. So I don't think that the drive-by scenario is applicable, because I just don't think that the motivation to do it makes sense, and I don't think the public would stand for it. I think with good outreach and publication of the evaluation, and we would be happy to be part of that along with other civic groups, I think the public can make that judgment, and we should entrust the voters to play at least that part in the selection process. Thanks for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you. Senator Gerlach.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have a couple questions. I'm undecided about this bill, and I've spent quite a bit of time trying to learn as much as I can about it. I'm new to the issue. I'm not a lawyer. I don't know a whole lot about the whole judicial world, so to speak, and trying to make the right decision. And one of the I feel like the burden, there's a steep burden of proof, if I can use a legal term, on those proponents of a bill or any bill, that there is a problem, here's the problem, here's the solution. And so I'm trying to understand that, and I know that Judge Whelan, you mentioned that you discounted the imminent threat argument, that we should wait. One of my initial reactions is that we should. Maybe I'm wrong on this, so that's why I want to ask you the question, is that if it hasn't happened yet, I mean, I understand that this is not something that we can't fix if it does happen here. I'm thinking, why don't we, why can't we wait and see? And I know you said, well, okay, Wisconsin had this election. We've heard several times about this infamous Wisconsin judicial race that cost $6 million. I know nothing of that case. Is there a stronger argument more than, look, this is what's happening in Wisconsin, and I don't know that these things necessarily geographically go like this. I mean, it could happen in Oklahoma or Delaware or Oregon, for all we know, and then could jump to Minnesota. I mean, I don't think it's a geographic march. But is there a stronger argument against this, why can't we wait? And then I would also like to ask you, what has been the outcome of that Wisconsin election? Somebody won. Was it the challenger? Was it the incumbent? And I don't know who got all this money, and what happened to the level of justice in that district or with that judge. Have there been complaints? Have the citizens of that district or that county or whatever it is in, have they lost confidence in the judiciary now because of that? What has been the result of that?
Judge Whelan.
Senator Gerlach and members of the committee, I don't know if Justice Anderson has already left. As I understand, he actually has a little bit more information about this situation in Wisconsin than I do. I don't know if it's appropriate to ask him to come up and answer your question, but if it is, I think he knows a little bit more about this than I do.
we can. I don't pretend.
Justice Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Gerlach, I don't pretend to be an expert on this. I will just simply say that this was a Supreme Court race. It was an open seat, and it has sparked all kinds of conversation in Wisconsin about what the next step is. Here is the problem from my perspective. The thing that I draw from this is that if you look at states that have encountered the partisan, nonpartisan races, it becomes very difficult to enact reform, because the parties have a vested interest in the system as it then exists. One of the messages we kept hearing from other states as we talked to them is, how did we get the Defense Lawyers Association and the Trial Lawyers Association to sit at the same table and talk about this? How did we get people who had strong Republican backgrounds and Democratic backgrounds, deep partisans? And I don't mean that critically, but I mean people like Vance Opperman and Annette Meeks and folks who, these are names that are going to be familiar to members of this panel, I think. How did we get them at the same table and get them to unanimously agree that this is a problem that needs attention? Part of the reason is we have the great good fortune of not having gone down this slope that other states have gone down.
And so, and I don't want to underestimate the difficulty of the challenge that's before us. The last state that I know of to have a vote of the public to move in the direction of a reform effort was Utah in 1984. So this is a difficult thing to do, and I don't underestimate the challenge that folks have in trying to get their arms around it. It's tough for all of us, including judges. But if we wait, my argument is if we wait for the train wreck, and I used to be a proponent of the train wreck theory. I used to think, you know, let's just wait for a disaster, and then, by gosh, people will be convinced. But you know what? You find that people become invested in the train wreck system, and it becomes hard to get the partisans to the table to talk about solutions. So that's where I come from in responding to that question.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Roebling.
Justice Anderson, were both of those candidates endorsed by political parties in Wisconsin?
Here's what's
Justice
interesting.
Anderson.
I'm sorry, I can't remember to wait here. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Roebling. Here's what's interesting about that. Wisconsin has the same model that we have, which is a nonpartisan. So technically speaking, as I understand what transpired in Wisconsin, those candidates for the office of Supreme Court Justice were not endorsed officially by either political party. But the players, in terms of fundraising and in terms of lining up supporters, were all the kinds of folks that you'd expect to see lining up in their respective camps. And this is one of the things, I mean, sometimes we overemphasize white because I think some of these issues exist in states where they didn't have the white-related issues. But the truth of the matter is I'm not sure that the distinction between nonpartisan elections, where the party name doesn't appear on the ballot, and partisan elections, where the party name does appear on the ballot, I'm not sure those distinctions have much validity anymore post-white. So I hope that's responsive to your question.
Senator Garrett.
Just real quick, because I would like to learn more about the details of the Wisconsin situation. What do I Google? What was the name of the Wisconsin judicial election? Since we talked about Google earlier.
I can give you, Senator Gerlach, Mr. Chairman, Senator Gerlach, I will provide that information to you.
Appreciate that very much.
Which I can see that you get 17,000 Google responses right. is the right one? Is that?
I'd like to know the details.
Okay, I've seen four people gather around this table before. I think I'll get the last four proponents together and try to get through this so that we have plenty of time to hear. I know that there's opposition as well. So if we could call. Oh, there's only three, I'm told. So Dan Michael, Mike Ford, and Michael Sieben. Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record.
I am Dan Michael, the President Emeritus of the Minnesota AFL-CIO State Retiree Council, and I represented Minnesota AFL-CIO on the CUI Commission, which began two years ago now. The Minnesota AFL-CIO position is the following. We have a convention position opposing partisan judicial elections in Minnesota, and I'll read a short statement by President Ray Waldron, quote, "Selecting judges should involve discussions of fairness, impartiality, and a candidate's understanding of the rule of law. Partisan concerns should have no place in judicial elections. And Minnesota would be wise to take steps now to keep out judicial campaigns free from these influences." Close quote. Partisan 20 or 30-second TV or radio ads attacking a judicial candidate or promoting a candidate will not edify, you know, anyone. A DVD is available showing several such ads from across the country. And I think the members of the legislature have that DVD, and it only takes 5 minutes to see the whole thing. It is as terrifying to watch those ads as it is to read John Grisham's latest book, The Appeal, which is about buying of a judicial election in the state of Mississippi, except it really took place in Alabama. Okay, there is a thoughtful, substantive process for nomination of judges and eventual performance evaluation proposed in the legislation before you. Okay. The right of the people to vote on judicial elections is maintained in Senate File 2401. Okay. The legislature will not take away the people's right to vote by deciding on judicial candidates themselves. The Performance Evaluation Commission will not take away the people's right to vote by deciding on judicial fitness. The people will decide by voting in a retention election, yes or no. The Minnesota AFL-CIO State Retiree Council urges passage of Senate File 2401. I'm under 5 minutes.
Way under. Thank you. Mike Ford?
Yes.
State your name for the record. Offer your testimony.
Thank you. My name is Mike Ford. I'm an attorney with the Quinlivan and Hughes Law Firm in St. Cloud, and I'm the president-elect of Minnesota State Bar Association. Our president, Brian Melendez, was required by a judge to be in Chicago today. Otherwise, he'd be making these comments. The Minnesota State Bar Association recommends that you pass Senate File 2401. At the beginning of this legislative session, the Bar Association was favoring the minority position, which called for an appointive system. The Bar Association has come around to the view that the best solution is what is in front of you here today. When the Bar Association voted on this at its annual meeting, we gave ourselves the flexibility of going with either system, favoring the minority position, which was a point of elections. However, based on the debate and the discussion that we've been part of, we've come to the belief that the system that's being presently put to you right now is the best and the one that should be accepted by this body. I can't add much to what's already been said. I served on the CUI Commission as well. I served for 6 years on the Judicial Selection Commission. Beyond those qualifications, I'll offer one other. It's the only one I can offer for you. 40 years ago, I played 2 years for St. John's football team under Coach John Gallardi. And over the years, people have asked me, how is it that over 50 years he could amass the record that he has, which is the most wins of any football coach in the country ever? And the only observation I can give you about that relates to this is that when John Gallardi coaches a football team, he makes sure that each player is never tested beyond his ability. He never makes, as we used to call it, a player make the offside block, which requires almost an inhuman effort on the part of the player. Instead, he sets each player up so that they can succeed and the team can succeed. If we don't change the way that we elect judges, we're going to require all of our judges to execute the offside block. They're going to have to almost have superhuman self-control and not do what the law allows them to do, raise the money and campaign the way the law allows them to. And that's the reason why I personally am in favor of us making this kind of a change, even though I'm like a lot of people, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. Well, I learned playing for John Gallardi that if you see a situation that you know the players aren't going to be able to live up to, then change the system. And that's what we have to do. Thank you.
Thank you. Michael Sieben?
My name is Mike Sieben. I practice law down in Hastings. I live in Woodbury. I'm here, although I'm a member of many different bar associations. I've been a trial lawyer for 35 years. I'm here on my own volition, not representing any association or any client, but just because I have an interest in the legislation, because that's what I've done for a long time is go to court representing clients. And I served here in legislature for 10 years from 73 to 82 and served as Governor Perpich's chairman of his Judicial Selection Commission from 83 to 89. So I've had an interest in this for a long time for a lot of reasons. And before I just offer my quick comments, and I will make them real quick, I just want to say one thing. It's kind of ironic today to see Governor Cui here, for me at least, because if you look at the headline in today's Minneapolis Star Tribune, you see that we're faced with a terrible budget shortfall. And it's like deja vu for myself and Roger Moe and Governor Cui, because it was late in that biennium, 1982, in Governor Cui's last several months in office, that we fashioned a compromise, largely through Governor Cui's leadership, and I commend him. And I commend him for his leadership on this issue. And that's the thing about this issue that I think is interesting. It's really a nonpartisan issue. It's really a nonpartisan issue. I just am fiercely loyal to our court system because I go there all the time. And it's a good system, and it's worked well But I also have a lot of apprehensions. Because of the things you've already heard, I won't repeat them. In part, the case law that's come down that I think accelerates the influence of partisan politics in the judicial system. And I think that's a wrong way to go. I think the right way to go, there's no perfect way, but I like what the Cui Commission is recommending. I didn't appear before him. I didn't follow it at all. I just read about this, and I thought about it, and I thought the right way to go, as far as I'm concerned, is to continue to make sure we have a system that keeps our judicial system fiercely independent. And that's what I like about this proposal. It isn't perfect, but it does have, I think, a good compromise because it allows for judicial elections in the future, but it also balances those with a nonpartisan or a bipartisan recommendations of their panel. So I like it. I think it's a great idea, and I encourage the passage. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions of members? Seeing none, we'll start. Thank you all for your testimony in support of Senate File 2401. We'll start, hearing from those in opposition. Judge Susan Miles, Judge Kathleen Guerin, and Judge John Hoffman, welcome to the committee. State your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We agreed between the three of us that Judge Hoffman would go first.
That's fine. Judge Hoffman, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Rest, sponsor of our bill today. My name is John Hoffman. I'm a district court judge. I am a district court judge in the 10th Judicial District. I am chambered in Anoka, Minnesota. I have been a district court judge for 11 years. I have been elected twice in uncontested elections. My history is I was a county attorney before that. I was elected twice in public elections, uncontested. I've been a city council member in the city of Princeton. I was elected in a nonpartisan contested election as a city council member. That is the background I bring into the judiciary. I am also the MDJA treasurer, and I am here today simply to give this committee information about your decision-making process. The MDJA has been actively studying the topic of elections for approximately 15 years. The election committee has been studying this matter on an ongoing basis and made recommendations to the MDJA membership and the board. We've had many fine judges studying the issue of retention and how our process works over many years, and we have come to some conclusions. In 2002, the MDJA board and membership took a firm position that the present system of merit selection and appointment combined with the election of judges with an incumbent designation was preferred over a retention system. The MDJA appreciates the potential problems that could occur but have not yet been caused by the White decision, but nevertheless has voted not to change its position and maintains its 2002 position. This is not to say that there are members of our association that believe some change may be necessary, and we acknowledge that. The trial bench remains equally concerned and as divided as others in the legal community on this issue. It appears that there are two major problems identified by the decision in White that are sought to be remedied. The fear of late stealth attacks against judges during campaigns initiated by partisan, political, or limited interest groups, with the inability of the judge to respond at such a late date in the election process, or concerns regarding fundraising to conduct an election which is costly to the candidates and the system, and the attendant fundraising obligations put on the judiciary, and the concept that money may, in fact, influence judges that are in contested elections. It should be noted that neither of these fears have come to pass. It is worth noting that three election cycles have occurred since the White 1 decision, and the fears expressed by those seeking the change have not yet come to pass. In 2006, election candidates for the trial court bench have sought political affiliation, Those that did were soundly defeated, and in fact, one of those candidates did not make it out of a primary. Historically, about 10% of judicial elections are actually contested and involve fundraising. This conversely means that 90% of judges on average do not face contested elections and therefore do not fundraise. Under a retention system, however, every judge would be up for a contested election and reasonably would see the need to fundraise. This means approximately 40% of the judiciary every 2 years would be fundraising for a contested retention election out of the legitimate fear of being targeted by some special interest group challenging one or more controversial decisions made by that judge. Finally, as to the two major reasons to seek a constitutional change in our election system, is the belief that a proposed retention system does not solve the problems presented. It will not take out the possibility of late attacks out of the system and may, in fact, enhance the possibility of such late attacks. It will not take out big money interests out of the election system. The retention proposal is not an improvement over the present system in the official position of the MDJA. It does not reduce or eliminate the need for fundraising by judges, and in fact will compel judges to be more intentional about setting up campaign committees and be more determined and intentional about raising campaign donations. Under the current system, it is difficult to defeat an incumbent judge unless there is good cause to run against that judge and there is a viable candidate that's willing to file against that judge. We have submitted through our lobbyist documentation that in retention states the dynamics are changing and judges have become more targeted by single-issue groups, and retention elections are not the quiet elections they used to be, and I recommend you to that those filings. If there is to be real change that actually solves the issues raised by White, it appears that a solution lies in the minority report authored by Brian Melendez or past legislation proposed by now Judge Tom Neville. So I would encourage all of you to be cautious about this. It is significant when the legislator considers a constitutional amendment, particularly about the election of publicly elected officials. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, my name is Susan Miles. By way of my personal background, I have been a judge for 11 years. I'm sitting in Stillwater, which is Washington County, of course, which is part of the 10th Judicial District, eight counties wide. I was elected to an open seat in 1996, started out in a field of 12, and here I am today. Came to that background from, or came to that from 19 years plus in private practice and government service. On behalf of MDJA, I am appearing as vice president. I am also vice chair of the Judicial Election Committee and now newly appointed chair of the Performance Evaluation Committee. We're moving forward and we're looking at all of the angles on this. And I want to repeat what Judge Hoffman said, which is that we have studied this for years and years and years. I have been on the Judicial Elections Committee since approximately 2000. We've had many debates. And most recently, as you've seen, there's now kind of, if you will, a minority report coming from district judges from around the state who have been themselves looking at the issue and have concluded that retention elections would be preferable to the system that we have now. However, the organization's position remains that we have not changed our position since we last voted in 2002. I would recommend to you in your materials a piece which extracts from a rather lengthy report that was written by our Elections Commission in committee in 2002 and reaffirmed in a vote in 2005, which sets forth all the advantages and disadvantages of various means of retaining and selecting judges. There's a one-page synopsis of that in your materials. One thing that hasn't been mentioned here today is the impact of detention elections on the impartiality and independence of sitting judges. And there is research out there that has not been mentioned, conducted specifically in the arena of retention elections in death penalty cases. But the researchers, who are widely respected, have found that when a judge is sitting for a retention election, in the period of time immediately prior to sitting for retention election, all of a sudden they seem to have a change of heart on the issuance of the death penalty. Now, granted, we're not a death penalty state, but you can easily picture a judge who would be up for retention election and knows that the special interest groups may be looking over his or her shoulder within the next few months, letting that fact have an impact on whatever their decision is going to be in what may be a controversial case. And though we don't have death penalty cases in the state of Minnesota, we do have plenty of controversial cases. So I would agree with the last speaker, Mr. Sieben, that we all want fiercely independent judges, but I would not want to suggest that retention elections necessarily guarantee true independence and impartiality. In my role as chair of the Performance Evaluation Committee, which is about to have its inaugural meeting on Friday, I just want to make a couple of comments. And I also come by this information in my role as together with some judges from around the country. I'm presently authoring an article on performance evaluation systems from around the country. I would note that the move towards the public performance evaluation system began by issuance by the ABA back in 1985 of some suggested criteria that should be used in public performance evaluation systems. Since then, only seven states have adopted this system. Minnesota has looked at the question of performance evaluations for its judges, most recently in the 90s, and concluded that while it's a good idea, there's no money to fund it. And so that responsibility was kicked to the districts to handle as best as they could without any budget. I would point out to you that it might be a good idea to take a strong look at the bill, as in the check for funding a fair and accurate performance evaluation system. It's a very, very detailed and arduous process. Other states, Arizona has been cited here frequently. Last year, their budget was approximately $400,000 just to evaluate 66 judges. There's also been made of a midterm evaluation process, which would help judges improve before they're actually up for election. But no mention has been made as to support for that improvement, such as funding judicial education programs. So there is a very significant price tag involved with the evaluation process. And in these tough times with judicial budgets that are very squeezed, to suggest that the evaluation process simply be covered from under some rock in the judicial budget is not going to do this proposal any good. Thank you.
Thank you. Judge Guerin?
Yes, I'm Judge Kathleen Guerin from the 2nd Judicial District, which is St. Paul. In looking out the left-hand window in this beautiful sunset tonight, I'm reminded of the joke, I can see my courthouse from here, literally, the top of it. I've been a judge for 21 years. I was elected to begin with in an open seat, as was the first woman trial court judge ever in Minnesota, Suzanne Sedgwick, as was the first African-American Supreme Court Justice, Ellen Page, as were two of the first five women on my bench, and as were many of the early women on benches throughout this state. For my district, we have 29 judges. We've spent a lot of time discussing this issue, debating it, researching it, over the years, even more intensely during the past year. 29 of 29 strongly oppose retention elections and favor retention of the present system at this time. There's almost nothing we agree upon from who gets which chambers down, or up, I hope, that we do agree upon this. We have, I would say, Ramsey, along with Hennepin County, are the two benches that have the most diversity of gender, age, and race in the state. Why? We could get into all kinds of reasons why we oppose retention, and a lot of that you've had. I'm not going to be repetitious. I think with my bench and with a number of judges in the state, and I'm aware that judges are divided on this. We are divided. We're respectfully divided, and today I come here respectfully not only for the committee, but also for the people who presented on the other side. These are good people. These are good people with good intentions. The bottom line, I would say, from my bench is we do not believe a constitutional amendment should be passed or should even be recommended lightly. There should not be changed without a consensus. What we have now is division. Division among judges, division even in the original Quay Commission upon a retention versus other possible systems that we should have. Division among lawyers, I believe citizens are also divided. It will be a difficult fight. Someone asked when's the last time this came. Justice Anderson mentioned 94, but there was an attempt to have retention elections in South Dakota, and I think that was 2004. That was soundly defeated by the people of South Dakota. I am not ready to give up my hope, my belief that the people of Minnesota can be trusted regarding judicial elections. Yes, they don't often, you know, they don't pay attention a lot of times. When there is a contested election, I can assure you, they pay attention, they ask the right questions, and they talk about it. Lastly, regarding retention elections, one of the things that I tried to look at in considering this was in the past, in the 70s, when there were retention elections, I don't think there were a lot of really what I call dirty ones. But the atmosphere today is different. It's different in politics. It's different in talk radio. It's different in much of our other media. The retention elections of today, to use another car analogy, it's not your father's Oldsmobile. They will not do away with money. Business interests or anti-business interests play a major factor in other states in terms of the money behind those behind retention elections and especially in trying to get rid of judges. Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Rust?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Judge Guerin, you mentioned among those who were elected in open seats, Justice Page. And I just want to make sure that the members know that Justice Page is a strong supporter of Senate File 2401 and did testify to that effect in the for the majority report for the Quay Commission in the informational hearing that we had. And you also asked that we work toward consensus, and it seems to me that with the support that we now have from the Bar Association for the bill, working with them, who in the person of Brian Melendez, their president, was the author of the minority report, that's exactly what we're trying to do, is to work toward consensus. The majority report is not only what is reflected in the bill that's before you now, but a lot of suggestions from the minority report, and we truly do take it seriously and you know, accept your recommendation to work toward consensus, and we have been doing that.
I'm aware of Justice Page's position. I didn't mean to imply, if I did, that he had some other position. I don't mean that. I also might point out that we've had a number of contested elections against incumbents in my district. Two of them have been minority judges. Both of those minority judges won, and both of them are strongly against retention elections.
Thank you. Senator Larson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think, Judge Miles, you had mentioned sort of a second minority report
maybe an informal one. I looked through here and I didn't find one, but I did find the – is this what you're referring to, is opinions of different districts that are taking an opinion?
Senator Lowry, Senator Larson, yes. You've got a resolution from the 8th District, the 7th District, and I guess the poll that was taken by the 1st District was done by email but not reduced to written resolution.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Senator Judge Larson. Miles. I don't have the 1st District, and maybe that's in our – what was the outcome of the email poll?
Judge Miles.
Senator Lowry, that was the – I wrote the numbers down from another witness. I think of 36 members in the district, 26 responded and 21 were in favor of retention elections.
Okay. Mr. Chair.
Senator Larson.
You know, and I've gone back and forth on this, and I don't know that I'm entirely sure where I end up, although I kind of feel myself ending up where Justice Anderson was, that there's a great deal of fear of what's about to come, and I'm looking – Senator Gerlach and I have been looking through the book of what some of those ads look like in other states, and some of them are pretty vicious, and I sure don't want that to come to Minnesota. And so I am concerned about that. But I just wanted to try to get a better sense of where the district court judges are. I know that the association has taken a position, and but having seen this, I'm just curious in what way the association arrived at that. Was that a close vote? Was it a poll of the membership on the Cui report, or was it? And I don't know how your association operates, but I'd be curious to know more about that. And as we're trying to find our way here,
Judge Miles,
Senator Lowry, Senator Larson, we had a membership meeting in December of this year. First, let me preface this by saying the population of district court judges in Minnesota is approximately 300, and I think about 9/10 of us belong to the District Judges Association. Our general membership meeting was held in December, and it was by far and away the most heavily attended membership meeting that I've ever seen in my 11 years on the bench. We had, prior to that meeting, conducted a survey, which did have a very high response rate, and the results of which were mixed. And some of the results were consistent, and some of the results were inconsistent. And so we've spent a lot of time debating the meaning of the outcome of the survey. At the membership meeting, there were a variety of motions made and votes taken. It was a parliamentary nightmare, quite frankly, and the upshot of it was that perhaps one of my colleagues here can correct me if I'm wrong, because, frankly, I lost track of what was happening. But there was a motion made to reaffirm our current position, and I believe, help me out here, that was ultimately tabled. And so there was no change in our current position. It was one of the most baffling things I ever saw. Let's just say that reasonable minds differed on which direction we ought to go in. And since our historic position had been that we opposed retention elections and supported the present system with incumbency on the ballot, that's where we remained. Prior to that membership meeting taking place, there had been a similar debate and vote in the Elections Committee. Again, a motion was made to affirm or change our historic position, and that there weren't enough votes to change our position. So it's been close all along the way. The two resolutions that you have before you were passed by a total of, I think, about 36 judges. The 8th District has 11 judges, and the 7th District, I believe, has about 25 judges. So they together represent approximately 10% of the judges in the state of – district court judges in the state of Minnesota.
Okay. Senator Larson.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and not to belabor the point of what the process must be like in the association, but I'm just trying to get a sense of, you know, is there a brisk discussion occurring, and is it a close vote, or is it overwhelmingly – that the judges oppose retention elections, and what I'm kind of getting the sense of is that there's a real division there, and that that even within the association leadership, it's sort of a split, albeit more votes and not knowing what the split is, more votes against the elections than the retention elections than for. But I'm just trying to get a sense of that as I think we feel some momentum building with the Bar Association, as Senator Rest has mentioned, in the legal community sort of in a large way getting around this proposal and its ability to change. I was real concerned about the on-ballot marking of acceptable or unacceptable. When that discussion was had, that made me real concerned. Some of that has been changed. So I sense some compromise here, and yet I'm still struggling a little bit because this is a big change. But I appreciate your comments,
Senator Roebling. And then we're probably going to have to move to the last three sets unless there's a pressing question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And maybe this is for Senator Rest. But I'm wondering, when Judge Hoffman brought up the issue of the money, raising money to protect yourself in case you're attacked, and then another group could be raising money to do the attack in a retention election, what would be the reporting requirements? How would the public know who's contributing money? In a typical election, we would have, you know, the campaign committees reporting to ethical practices. Would they fall under the same rules, and would the public know where the money was coming from?
Senator Rest.
Chairman and Senator Roebling, certainly under the current law now with White, as I understand it, and Mr. Watson, Mr. Bodden can maybe provide better information, the judges, people running for election and judge, could certainly know who is contributing money to them. And that, and quite frankly, that's one of the concerns about this that I do have is the current law is the so you have a judge, and here comes a lawyer in front of him in a case, and he contributed or she contributed, $500 to their campaigns. Now, legislators like to say that when somebody sits there and it's a huge contributor to their campaign, that it doesn't make any difference, and we certainly hope it wouldn't make any difference. But that kind of money, I think, does have an influence, and I don't think it's a particularly good one. The notion that, on the other hand, that when dollars are raised, which, as I understand, pre-White, they are raised to support an election, but not the candidate himself or herself is not privy to the names of the people making the contribution. And I don't know whether campaign finance laws are addressed by this new proposal or whether we would have to make in the future similar kinds of changes. And I would defer to Mr. Watson or Mr. Bodden, if that's okay with you.
Mr. Watson?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Rest, let me divide the kinds of reporting we have into three, one for candidates, one for independent expenditures, and one for neither, issue expenditures. The reporting for expenditures by candidates and contributions to candidates is very clear and straightforward, I think, and everybody in this room is familiar with how that works. The change that this would make would be that in a judicial election, there'd be only one candidate. So you could see that the money that was going to and the money that was being spent by the judge who was up for retention, but there wouldn't be another side to be looking at, another candidate to see the reports of the money going to that candidate. Now, what you might see would be reports of independent expenditures. If there is a group that's organized to direct its efforts against a specific candidate and naming that candidate, then they would have to file reports of independent expenditures and say that this expenditure was made against a certain judge. And there would be I think, decent reports of that spending and the contributions to that group that was making that spending. If there were in a judicial election, and I don't know whether in any of these retention elections in other states there have been campaigns that would be issue campaigns, citizens for an impartial judiciary, against an impartial judiciary, citizens against the death penalty, or citizens against gun violence, or some other group that has perhaps a well-financed campaign, but they are not naming an individual judge and not saying, or maybe they are naming, but they're not saying vote for or against that judge, then those would not be considered campaign expenditures under our law, and they would not have to be reported as a contribution to the opponent of the sitting judge, and they wouldn't have to be reported as independent expenditures.
Mr. Chairman,
under arrest.
I think, as I recall the testimony from prior witnesses, the amount of money that has been spent in retention elections is far surpassed by states in which there are nonpartisan or partisan election of judges, similar to what we've had pre-White, and we have post-White, and in other states, and since 2000, that's where the big money is being spent. And again, it is I can understand the suggestion that we don't have the problem here yet, and that the people who ran with party designation lost. But indeed, there was a step toward doing that, and it seems to me that it's not going to be, it's certainly not unheard of or beyond the realm of possibility that we could very quickly move to a tax on a judge by another candidate and get to the point where we would be seeing those kinds of ads. And I think, as people have pointed out, they're almost always negative. They're not ads saying, support this judge, he's a great guy, or she's a great woman. They are scurrilous ads attacking judges as being in the pockets of, you name it, special interest. And it seems like to me that's the kind of thing that we want to avoid, and we do have the opportunity to avoid it, as opposed to just having one election in which a couple million dollars is spent, and then the as was pointed out, the special interest have such a vested interest in making sure that system stays in place that we could never go to, or it's unlikely that we would move again to a reform stance in terms of trying to not retain a impartial judiciary, but to get it back after we've lost it. And so I think, you know, money is there, but I think we see it in the evidence that we've been given by both the judges and Justice Anderson that it's far more prevalent and nasty in the partisan elections like we had in Wisconsin, and likely there to have again.
Mr. Chairman?
It's Mr. Watson.
If I might supplement my answer on the campaign reporting, we have a loophole in our law on reporting of last-minute expenditures that Senator Rest passed a bill through the Senate last year to close, which is in the last 17 days before the general election, expenditures can be made and not reported until the next January 31st. And if the concern is about independent expenditures that would be made attacking a particular judge and in the last 17 days of the campaign, then without the passage of Senator Rest's bill, those expenditures could be made and there would be no reporting of them until January 31st.
And, Mr. Chairman, that bill is did pass the Senate with strong bipartisan support, but as is the case with many election bills, languishes in the Minnesota House of Representatives.
Well, in the interest of time, we are supposed to have this room only till 6 p.m. I would like to try to get to a vote. I don't want to skip anybody's opinions or questions. This is a very important issue, but I will call the last three testifiers up. And judges, you should maybe stay close too, because we may have some more questions for you. So if you're available after these last three witnesses, that would be helpful possibly as well. Phil Carruthers, Tom Pritchard, and Steve Reeves, welcome to the committee. State your name for the record and offer your testimony.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman and members. My name is Phil Carruthers. I am an assistant Ramsey County attorney. I'm the head of the prosecution division for Ramsey County Attorney's Office. I got into this as an individual. I read the Quay Commission report, and I was very concerned when I read it because I saw that, in my opinion, it was going to throw off the checks and balances in a really significant way between the different branches of government, that it substantially enhanced the power of governors and of chief justices, and I was very concerned that that was going to create checks and balances problems, going to create concentration of powers problems. Since my individual involvement, the Minnesota County Attorneys Association, the board has taken a position against this. I'm not a member of that board. I'm not an elected county attorney. In addition, AFSCME Council 5, which represents many public defenders, represents many assistant county attorneys and other personnel in the court system, they've taken a position against it. And I do want to mention that at the State Bar Association, at the Legislative Assembly, I was there, and their motion was that to support the minority report, but with a also support for the majority report. They preferred the minority, but also as a backup, the majority report. That passed by one vote. It was a very spirited debate. It passed by one vote. So I have to say, I think that practicing attorneys are a lot more split on this than you might get the impression. Let me say a few things about the policy issue. You know, Minnesota has really different laws than other states, and it's really an apples and oranges situation. The states that you, when you read these ads or see these ads, they are almost always states with, by law, partisan judicial elections. What that means is it's right on the ballot under the candidate's name, and or they have partisan primaries, okay? So if Phil Carruthers was running for judge, it would say under Phil Carruthers what my party was, and it would have the party of the other individual, okay? That's a whole different thing. So, you know, when you hear about Texas, Louisiana, Alabama, West Virginia, Pennsylvania, Ohio, Michigan, they're all states with, by law, partisan judicial elections. The other big difference is in Minnesota, almost all the judges are appointed. 99% of judges in Minnesota are appointed. They do not run in open elections. Less than 1% run in open elections. That's what makes it really different than Wisconsin, for example. When you hear about Wisconsin, they have frequent open Supreme Court elections. Can you imagine that? You're talking about a big job, Supreme Court of the state of Wisconsin. Of course they're going to have highly expensive and combative elections because it's an open seat on the Supreme Court, which is a very powerful position. In Minnesota, in the last 40 years, we've had only two open seats on the Minnesota Supreme Court. It's really a rarity. Washington State is another state that you hear about. They have a state where if you get over 50% in the primary, you've won the election, okay? Totally different deal where you really have to spend money in order to get make sure that primary election voters, who are, of course, a small percentage of the overall vote, know what's going on. So you have to make that distinction with other states. A big thing that we have to keep in mind here is that White declared constitutional rights, okay? So constitutional rights apply across the board. And it doesn't compute, in my opinion, to say that, well, if we just change the type of election, that that's going to change the constitutional rights that are asserted by people. Just because you go to a retention election doesn't change those constitutional rights at all. So if people want to have partisanship or special interest group involvement, it's going to take place in a retention election just as much. Now, Minnesota hasn't had a problem under White, and they're saying, well, but retention election states haven't had a problem. But they're saying, well, but that might change in Minnesota. Well, why doesn't the same logic apply to retention elections? You know, in Minnesota, less than 1% of judges lose. Less than 1% of judges lose. 1996 to 2006, after White, many of those elections, two of those elections, or three of those elections, there have been three defeats of 446 judges, okay? So there has not been a problem since White in Minnesota. And all you're doing is you're changing from one type of election to another type of election, but an election where 90% of the judges don't have opponents to one where all of them are on the ballot, okay? Thank you.
Thank you very much. Tom Pritchard?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. My name is Tom Pritchard, President of the Minnesota Family Council, and I come with some concerns about the legislation. I think we all want a judicial system that's impartial, impartially dispenses justice, and has respect and confidence of the people of Minnesota. And I think it's critical that judges remain accountable to the people. I think, frankly, one of the most dangerous abuses of power in our system of government can be unaccountable judges. And my concerns with the legislation are that it will reduce accountability to the people of Minnesota. First, it pushes out elections from 6 to 8 years, which further insulates, judges from accountability to the public. And second, it sets up a selection process isolated from the people and the public. Basically, what you're going to be having are unelected, unaccountable individuals deciding who our judges are. And I don't think that's the direction we should go in terms of where we move ahead from here. I think accountability needs to attach to the people selecting the judges and the public. Under the proposal, the governor can basically say, I'm not accountable. I was just given these candidates, and I just have to choose one of them. On the other hand, the committee selection committee can say, well, we didn't choose the candidates. The governor did. So in a sense, I think it reduces that sense of accountability. I think it also, the proposal result in more kind of legal establishment community individuals being named judges. It becomes a much more insular process, and individuals may be viewed as unorthodox to the legal community, won't have a chance. And I'm concerned with another concern I have is the criteria for selection of judges. In Article 2, Section 10, Subdivision 4, they list a number of criteria the committee must consider. They do not include judicial philosophy, and I think that's, frankly, one of the most critical elements we need to look at in terms of our judicial candidates. Another concern I have is in Article 2, Section 9, Subdivision 2, and it concerns giving the Chief Justice power to decide who becomes a judge. That almost sounds like a conflict of interest. I think we want our judges to be impartial dispensers of justice, not selecting who their colleagues are. And I don't think it's appropriate to be giving the Chief Justice power in selecting who his future colleagues will be. And I don't necessarily think this process will remove politics. I think it may more submerge it in the commission process and out of sight, but I think it'll probably still be there. In conclusion, let me say that I'm not a fan of contested elections, and I have concerns about full-blown contested elections. And I'm not opposed to moving towards retention elections for judges, but I would suggest an alternative if you do move that direction. I think one is keep the judicial terms at 6 years. I think second, allow the voters to initiate the removal of a judge before the end of their term through a recall process. I think that would keep judges accountable as well, knowing that potentially they could be removed early. And then finally, I think keep the current selection process the way it is. Concerns have been expressed, I think, pretty much exclusively regarding the current system of our elections, the potential for money, ads, all that. It's not with the quality of the current bench. And I guess I would say if it's not broke, don't fix it. So thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Reeves?
I'm the immediate past president of the Minnesota chapter of the Asian Pacific American Bar Association. I'm just going to refer to it as NAPABA Minnesota or NAPABA MN. First of all, I'm very thankful today for the opportunity to testify. I'm also, in full disclosure, I'm a corporate attorney. So for all the judges in the room, I'm really glad that I don't have to practice in front of you in case this wrecks my future career. The reason that we're here today is not because we think that the current system is perfect or that we oppose the Cui Commission report or what 2401 is going to do. Very simple, and I have a lot of prepared testimony, but I will cut it down, and I don't know if I can offer the written item afterwards. But
absolutely.
Although we do not believe the current system is by any means perfect, the current system at least allows members of our community to seek judicial positions through an alternative process to a gubernatorial appointment. This change, we think, removes this alternative process and restricts future opportunities. I want to point out that right now there are three Asian judges serving. Judge Regina Chu and Judge Tony Leung were both appointed by the respective governors at the time. And also Judge Susan Burke ran in an election. We don't believe – oh, also I will point out that there are no Asian or Pacific American judges on the Court of Appeals or on the Supreme Court. And we don't believe that this is for a lack of qualified candidates. We think that the current system sort of works and gets there. It's just that there is a feeling that, hey, you know, we've got Asian judges, but our organization represents everybody ethnically from the eastern suburbs of L.A. to Constantinople. We are a very, very broad geographic group, although in the state of Minnesota we only cover about 3.5% of the population. We understand the impending problem. We believe that that exists, but we think that the solution maybe overstates the problem. Under the current system, from what I understand, most judges, and now I understand possibly as many as 99% of the judges, are appointed by the governor rather than elected by citizens of the state, and that elections only arise when a judge chooses not to run for re-election after serving the remainder of his term. We believe and we trust that the citizens of Minnesota will reject special influence when it comes to judicial elections. In particular, we believe that if special interest groups do get involved in judicial elections, that it will be much easier for those groups to influence a discrete number of selection committee members or the individuals in the political parties behind those appointments. Or put another way, the fatal flaw with what 2401 does is that the commission members will be chosen by other political figures who will almost certainly be subject to lobbying from powerful special interest groups. Therefore, we firmly believe that the current system of allowing judicial elections creates an important safety valve, as well as offering an alternate path to judgeship for underrepresented groups and those without substantial political capital. I would also like to point out that the system of retention elections proposed does not fix the identified problem with big money and special interest groups that are going to improperly influence judicial elections. We believe that under a retention election system, it will be easier for special interest groups or big money to vote a judge out of office, and we understand that typically minority judges are targeted in those types of elections, and thus more likely to invite the feared special interest group groups and money to Minnesota. Under a system involving retention elections, a judge would get no notice an attack or ambush was coming until it was too late. At least in the current system, the judge knows who his or her opponent is and can respond to any criticisms raised in a campaign. Also, some may fear that minority judges will be targeted, and in short, the retention election system proposed in connection with this legislation makes the identified problem worse and more likely to occur. I know I've been reading really fast. I just wanted to get some points in there. And also, we do want to point out that we are fully aware and we truly appreciate the honorable intentions of the Cui Commission and the lawmakers in the state. We know that the issue of minority representation was present in the minds of these individuals when they put together the various proposals. And while we believe that any proposed Merit Selection Commission would be charged with considering the diversity in the state's population, we are simply uncomfortable with the idea that a discrete group of individuals could adequately assess the needs and desires of the diverse citizens of this state. For example, and I have four examples, but I'll give only two. We are equally uncomfortable with both of the following scenarios. Number one, selection commission choosing a minority candidate over an equally qualified white male candidate, because this tends to paternalistically taint the integrity of the selection process. But we are also equally uncomfortable with the selection commission that would decide to set aside all information about race, gender, religion, or sexual orientation because it unfairly discriminates against disadvantaged minority groups. I've got 1 minute. Can I just answer one quick thing from Senator Roebling's comment earlier? I think one of the reasons, or at least, and I'm a young attorney, okay, I think that one of the reasons why after a judge loses an election but continues to serve out their term and there isn't really sort of a question about how they will behave is because judges have a judicial canon which they must abide by. Plus, we're all bound by the rules of professional conduct. And if you have any hope of a career afterwards, you have to remain a lawyer, so you can't get disbarred. And so I think that prevents them from sort of behaving with misconduct. And also, I'd like to believe that most of the people who run for judges have a sense of personal integrity that would prevent them from doing that. Thank you very much. I really appreciate the opportunity.
Thank you. Questions for this panel from the members? Senator Larson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And for Speaker Carruthers, I'd like to ask you a hypothetical question, if you will. And I
used to always say, Mr. Chairman, that when I was Speaker that I don't answer hypotheticals, but I will.
Okay. Mr. Carruthers. Well, thank you, Mr. Chair and Mr. Carruthers. I just would add that I, when I was elected in 1998, the first 2 years I sat in the legislature on the House floor was almost directly behind Phil Carruthers, and I learned a lot from you during that time. But this hypothetical is, and the reason I ask this is I was particularly compelled by the testimony of Justice Anderson earlier that that it's going to be harder if the problem gets to Minnesota to remedy it once it's here. That the reason to act now is because we don't have all the complications that come with a problem system in our midst, and people haven't taken sides. And it's easier to get groups together to reform the policy before it has various implications that we can't even predict. So I guess what I'm wondering is, from your perspective, if the problem that we see in the book, and if I can borrow this just briefly from Senator Gerlach, all the different ads, that the nasty ads, and we've all seen the different examples. If that were to come to Minnesota, in your opinion, is the Quay Commission report a movement in the right direction in terms of solving a problem like this, or what's your perspective on that in terms of what's the remedy for this if it isn't the Quay report?
Mr. Carruthers.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I can't say that I think that retention elections are a terrible idea, first of all. It's just that I'm not sure that they're going to solve the problem at all. These ads could just as easily be in a retention state. If a group, and it could be a partisan group, doesn't like an incumbent judge, they can run all these ads against the incumbent judge. You know, they can say Judge Phil Carruthers is soft on crime. He voted to release a sex offender. He refused to impose the death penalty in such a case. I mean, you can do all of those things. And, you make scurrilous accusations. You know, Phil Carruthers doesn't regularly attend church, or Phil Carruthers doesn't believe that the Ten Commandments have a place in the courthouse. You know, you can do all sorts of that stuff. So any of those ads could be done just as easily in a retention election, and, in fact, easier in a retention election. Because, in the last two elections, Justice Barry Anderson, he wasn't opposed, for example. In 2004, 2006, there were four Supreme Court justices who were up for election. Three of the four did not have opponents, whereas, now Justice Barry Anderson is on the ballot, and he doesn't know whether he's going to have an opponent or not, and he can easily get these last-minute attacks. So any of those ads that are done could just as easily be done in a retention election, and in fact, we have plenty of examples that they have been. California retention elections have been very nasty. Tennessee was mentioned, Penny White, because of one death penalty case. Nebraska Supreme Court Justice David Lanfear was defeated. Richard Teitelman on the Missouri Supreme Court was targeted. He wasn't defeated, but a very expensive and really negative race. Phyllis Schlafly went after him. The National Rifle Association went after him. Missourians for Family went after him. Wyoming, a sitting Supreme Court justice was defeated. You know, so all of those ads, you could take those ads and run them in a retention election, except now you got 100% of the judges that could have these ads, not the 10% currently that have opponents. You know, only 10% of judges have opponents currently. So that's my answer.
Thank you. Senator Roebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Rest, I kind of understand Mr. Pritchard's concern about the 8 years and the length of time. How did you arrive at that instead of something like six?
Senator Rest.
We would have to ask actually the members of the CUI Commission, as I understand it, because the performance evaluation was going to be taking place midterm and giving the judges an opportunity for, quote, self-improvement, so there's two evaluations that would take place, that was part of the argument justifying a longer term. I don't know that there was more to it than that in terms of the discussion on the CUI Commission, but we could certainly ask them. And I'm not, eight seems fine to me, but I don't know precisely the history of the discussion that it got there. And
Senator Roebling, would you like to hear from Governor CUI?
Maybe Governor CUI could tell us if that'd be okay.
Welcome back, Governor.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd be glad to respond. You see, as you read that commission report, we were divided between individuals who wanted the retention election and those who wanted a federal system. But in this regard, it was a concern is how do we draw the best, most capable individuals who wouldn't run for office in order to be there? And so what we did is two things. We extended by 2 years the initial term, and we extended by 2 years the regular term. And what it turned out, is in this case, it finally argued back and forth, keeping it at 6 years or going up to 12 years, it ended up with eight years. And you know how that is. You finally say, okay, this is the one that most of the people favor in that. That's where it turns out for it. But it was the intent to do it. It's the same way where we had the Merit Selection Commission and what I put it in when I was in office. There are many people would be outstanding judges, but they would never run for election. See? And they'd be so outstanding that they wouldn't have any trouble in a retention election. Because you have to look at retention elections. There's less than 0.5% that are defeated, while there's over 4% in contested elections that are defeated. So the proof is there.
Quick
Senator
follow-up.
Roebling.
Yeah. Is there any way if you had a judge who was not performing, wasn't even showing up for his cases, is there any way within that 8 years that he could be removed?
I understand there's a recall provision in the law right now. It's very difficult, but that's the only way it'd be recall. And then to the extent to which the judges really work with each other and say, you're giving everybody a bad reputation out there. I imagine that's out there as well. So, but no, you see, if we think we're going to have some rule or regulation that's going to take care of everything that might go wrong, and then I think we just be overwhelmed with regulation. You can't have government to go to that extent. So to what extent, you have to have some trust in this thing. So what we did was to look at those states that use these various systems. And when we had the combination of those four, we figured that's where it was flowing the best. And we look at the ones who were rated with the most competent and impartial judges that came that way. And so, frankly, if it wasn't for the White decision, we'd never be here. because we have a good system now. Not perfect, but a good system. But when we see what's happening, I mean, I just want to tell you in Wisconsin. 1 minute, okay.
Or less. Okay.
You know how they're going to remedy it right now, and the legislators are working on public financing? $100,000 in the primary, $300,000 in the general election. Did you hear it take $400,000 for the evaluations in Arizona? That'd be $400,000 for each candidate. If ever there would be challenges of government, of judges, is if the state paid for $400,000 for their campaign. And 507s can come in besides that, or 527s.
It looks like Mr. Carruthers wishes to respond, and I think I saw a few of the district judges hoping to weigh in as well. So
okay, I'll get out of their way. If they want to
Carruthers.
Well, Mr. Chairman, just a quick point. It's not just a matter of how long the term is extended, but the initial term, concerns me a lot, the initial term right now when you're appointed, you have to stand for election within 1 to 2 years. And basically that's so that, you know, because we don't have Senate confirmation for judges. That's so that the public can okay the appointment. Because, you know, otherwise you could have a governor just appoint some crony or his brother or whatever. You know, so they have to stand for election within 1 to 2 years. We're talking the next 150 years. We don't know that what a governor might do in the next 150 years. And what it does is it extends the term from now currently 1 to 2 years to 3 to 4 years. Now, that means to me that if you had a very bad judicial appointment, especially at the Supreme Court level, we hope it doesn't happen, but the voters would not have a chance to get rid of that person until 3 to 4 years. So that's a concern that I have.
Thank you. Did one of the district judges wish to speak on this as well?
I'll speak on one part of it.
Okay, I think some of the dissenting.
Senator Rolby, I think the two things to keep in mind, one is impeachment is always an option, although I don't think it's ever actually occurred in Minnesota. The more likely scenario, though, is that the Board of Judicial Standards, that whole process continues. And that's the example you gave of an individual who doesn't come to work or dereliction of duty. And chief judges currently have the obligation to manage their courts and to report to the Board of Judicial Standards when there is a judge who's not functioning appropriately, and the board has the ability and does, in fact, have that individual removed.
Thank you, Judge Weiland. Judge Miles?
Chairman Lurie and Senator Roebling, and indeed there's precedent for the Supreme Court having suspended a judge for dereliction of duties for a year prior to his term running out, and the handwriting was on the wall. He was not going to be able to survive an election. One other comment on the funding issue that just came up was that in the states where there have been major dollars poured into ad campaigns, those races have been fueled by the Chamber of Commerce and the trial lawyers' associations over tort reform issues and the like. In Minnesota, the Chamber of Commerce ranks our judiciary as second best in the country. They don't have an axe to grind with us. They're not going to open that door. And we've had enough tort reform in this state that the trial lawyers aren't going to open that door either. So that which generated the fights in other states really didn't have anything to do with White. It started to happen before White, and these were the two titans at the battle. Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Rest?
Mr. Chairman, is that the end of the testimony?
That is the end of the testimony. We'll have to ask the audience.
Go back to the table.
Yep. Please do.
And, Mr. Chair, just a quick point.
Senator Betzel.
Just a clarification on Judge Weiland's remark. The Board of Judicial Standards doesn't have the authority to remove a judge, but they would make the recommendation of the Minnesota Supreme Court, and they do have the authority to remove a judge.
Thank you for that clarification. Senator Rest.
Well, Mr. Chairman, we have had a very full hearing, and I appreciate the discussion and the questioning by the members. I do hope that you will vote affirmatively to send this bill on to the Judiciary Committee so that the discussion can continue, and that committee, which was jointly in the information hearing, can have their chance to take a whack at this bill as well. I do think we've come a long way, in particularly in gaining the support of the Bar Association. We all know that any number of decisions are reached by a majority of one vote, whether it's the Bar Association, although we've worked with them in a consensus-building way rather than looking at votes, or the district court judges that had a very convoluted process in arriving at the position that they have. But I do promise to keep working on it. I'm interested in the issue of the length of term, whether that's appropriate, and the issues that have been brought up there, and the concerns that were raised by Senator Betzold early on about the provisions in the bill to cover possible conflicts of interest on commission members, and the relationship that the commissions would have with the Judicial Standards Board.
Okay, well, I think I will ask the audience if there's anyone who has not yet had a chance to come up and weigh in on this, either in favor or against, if they would like to come forward now. Seeing none, I think we would entertain a motion.
Well, then,
Senator Betzold.
Mr. Chair. I think that judicial elections can get mean and ugly and expensive, and it could happen this year, but it might not. Mm-hmm. But it's going to happen at some point, I think. I don't know where it'll happen. I mean, if you try doing Hennepin County with 54 judges, it'd be very expensive to win one judicial seat on district court. I don't know that, you know, somebody might spend the money, or Ramsey County with 29 judges, or the Dakota County, or the eight counties that cover the 10th Judicial District where I live. Again, somebody could spend the money, but I don't think it'd be cost-effective to do that. The Court of Appeals is statewide, and if somebody tried to influence that kind of election, well, I don't know that, again, a spot on the Court of Appeals is prestigious, but what does it accomplish? You know, I mean, I'm a lawyer. I understand that. But I think that where the impact might be felt earliest might be in a district court judgeship in greater Minnesota, in a small area, one of the small counties, where the judges are quite well known. I mean, in the rural metro areas, nobody knows who's on the ballot. They don't recognize the names. In the greater Minnesota, they probably do. I think the real challenge, though, would be if somebody wants to try to spend the money to buy a seat on the Minnesota Supreme Court, and I think there are some groups that are capable of trying to do that. I think that's my real fear here. I would like to be proactive in this area, but I often tell people legislatures don't do anything proactive. We react very well, but we don't always do anything proactively. I don't know that this bill, as it's written, does solve the problem. I have some concerns about, you know, there's no consensus among the stakeholders, but we don't do things by consensus. We decide stuff here. We just as courts do, we have to vote yes or no. I don't know that the evaluation committee, you know, should have legislators in it. I don't know whether on the retention elections, I mean, I talked to Governor Cui about that very point that I had raised earlier. If, you know, if you have an unprepared incumbent who gets knocked off, well, you know, his response to me was, well, you know, they don't control the selection process for the replacement. And that's true, but some people may do it just because they think a sympathetic governor might then come up with a better replacement. So I think it can still happen even under this. Senator Rest, I'm not quite prepared to endorse this proposal as it's written, but I want to think about it. But I think we need to continue the discussion. I think, you know, stopping the bill now, I think, you know, would not be in the public's interest. So I'm on the Judiciary Committee. I'm on the only member of this committee who is. So I'm prepared to keep working on it, and I think it'd be in our interest, and I would move that the bill be referred to the Judiciary Committee without recommendation at this time.
Senator Rest.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Bodern, is that a higher motion than with recommendation?
Yes, it is.
Mr. Bodern.
Mr. Chairman, I think it is a higher motion. It's that which removes the bill furthest from passage, I believe, would be the criteria to apply.
Mr. Chairman, I certainly would like the bill to go to the Judiciary Committee with recommendation, and but I can understand that, I appreciate hearing from other members about how they would feel about sending it out without recommendation or sending it with recommendation.
Senator Gerlach had some comments.
Not on this motion.
Not on this motion. Senator Roebling?
I would support Senator Betzold's motion. I have just been puzzling over this for the last 2 months, and I can't say that I am ready to vote on this particular bill tonight. I think there may need to be some more changes, but I'm not ready to offer amendments. And I appreciate some of the changes that were made, that you came in with the delete all amendment. And yet I just am not, I'm not ready to recommend it. So I support Senator Betzold's motion.
Mr. Chair, I'm going to look at it a different way. We've had a lot of testimony. When you send a bill without recommendations, it just is the same thing a printer telling you the bill is no good and you don't want it to pass. Senator Rest has been here a long time. Senator Rest is a very powerful, very thoughtful legislator. I'm going to vote against your recommendation, Senator Betzel. And hopefully, I don't know if yours comes ahead of...
It does.
Mm-hmm. Okay, because maybe it's not perfect.
For clarification of the rules, if Senator Betzold's motion fails, we can still entertain a motion to send it on with recommendation, correct?
That's correct.
Mr. Chairman, I have been conferring with Mr. Watson here, who has a little bit more experience than I do in this regard, and... He points out that it would be in order to amend Senator Betzold's motion, which is the motion before the committee, Senator Rest could amend it for passage of the bill with recommendation. And you can take the vote on the amendment and then vote on the motion.
Mr. Chairman, that would be my motion to be able to have a clean vote on a recommendation. So I would move to amend the Betzold recommendation to have the effect of sending the bill out to the Judiciary Committee with recommendation.
Senator Rest moves to amend Senator Betzold's motion so that the Senate File 2401 would travel to the Judiciary with a recommendation to pass. Everyone understand that motion? Senator Gerlach.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So I understand this. Yep. This vote is on where it's going to go, but can we have some discussion afterwards? We haven't passed the
bill.
Yes,
we haven't
based
passed
on this.
This would put the motion before us as to whether the bill would pass with recommendation to pass or without recommendation. So everyone understand the motion before us? All right. So everyone in favor of Senator Rest's motion to amend Senator Betzold's motion such that this bill travels with a recommendation to pass. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed?
No. Request division, Mr. Chair.
A division has been requested.
You haven't called the vote.
Okay. Make your ruling.
He's got to make a ruling.
I was going to refer to my notes from the good Peter Watson over there. I haven't been through this before. It sounded like a division is entirely appropriate. I was going
to
call a division.
You have to make a decision. Which side?
I have to make a decision?
Yes. First and then the division.
Mr. Chairman, you have the authority to request
passed.
A division
okay.
yourself.
Okay,
division.
Now he says division.
Okay. All right. Request division.
We have a division. And so a division has been requested. All those in favor, raise your hands. Have four in favor. All those opposed, one, two, three, four, five, six. The motion fails.
So now we have the Betzold motion.
Now we have the Betzold motion to refer Senate File 2401 to the Judiciary Committee without recommendation in front of us. Senator Day.
We might as well let's just get out of here. Yeah.
Senator Day says, let's just get out of here. Whatever. Okay. Senator Gerlach.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I want to say a few just quick things. And It's Senator Betzold's motion and that vote there, it underscores, I think, the uneasiness of a lot of us here in that we're struggling with this because it'd be easy if there was a lot of consensus, there was a lot of agreement, but we're getting testifiers at the table, people we all respect, and we have you know, Senator Moen and Governor Kui, and then we have Tom Pritchard and Phil Carruthers, and we have labor at the table, and then I have a letter from Elliot's side here from another labor group saying they're on the other side. And so this makes it enormously difficult for us. And at the beginning, I mean, we all share the goals of impartiality, but what is the best solution? And with all this division, I am wrestling with the whole thing. I mean, is this, before we put this forth, there ought to be, I think, greater consensus. So, Senator Russ, I just wanted to say that this is not easy because I think something needs to be done. I don't know what the answer is. But we've got to figure out where the consensus is, and I still don't feel that there's an imminent danger. I understand the proactive and reactive arguments and such, but with all due respect to all the testifiers and such, I'm going to vote no today, but doesn't mean that I will continuing on. But I just wanted to let you know that I think that's what we're wrestling with. A lot of this is just so many unknowns.
All right.
Going to send it without recommendation.
We have vote. Senator Betzold's motion to that Senate File 2401 be sent as amended, be sent to Judiciary without recommendation. All in favor of this motion, signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed?
No.
No.
Motion carries.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members.
Thank you, Senator Rust. There being no further business before the Committee of State and Local Government Operations and Oversight, the committee stands adjourned. Thank you.
I mean, it really was.